Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host Jonathan Metz, and with me on this episode 325, we have John Lindemann.
I'm just dodging snowflakes up here, Johnny. Looking for 2 feet tonight.
Yeah! I was so excited when I saw you getting all that snow. You're gonna be...
Yep.
I hope I get that much too.
So John, how much snow does the fantastic hybrid handle?
About 2 inches. If I'm lucky, that thing's going to be on the bench tomorrow, believe me.
Man, I could use my own little like Ni No Kuni snowathon over the weekend. We'll see how it goes. We've also got, you just heard him, Mr. James Jones.
For no inches of snow tonight.
And, of course, Guillaume Veillette.
Shoo-be-doo.
Shoo-be-doo-be-doo. All right, guys. We are excited to bring you this episode tonight. We've got some excellent brand new business coming up in just a sec. And after the break, we've got another round of listener mail with some fantastic questions. We had way too many to do last week, so we're going to catch up on a few more. And we might even have a special guest drop in for that segment. So I'll leave it at that. First up, we've got James with the brand new Fire Emblem Awakening.
It is the brand new Fire Emblem Awakening. And first, let me speak to the audience.
What, as opposed to what?
Well, so this is a public service announcement more than anything. Hopefully by now, if you've been looking for this game, you've been able to find a copy, because Nintendo ain't helping. So just to speak of what people have gone through to try to find copies, I was actually at Target on Tuesday, I think. And I was not in the game section, but I saw multiple people go to the 3DS aisle, look at the shelf, stand there for a while looking, and then leave. So I pulled out my phone, and sure enough, it said they had a copies, but they didn't. You know why? Because they never got copies and anticipated some showing up.
Oof.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was... This game is ridiculously difficult to find.
I've heard that it may not be Nintendo's fault. It might have been some kind of shipping company logistical issue, but apparently the shipments were delayed by at least 3 or 4 days pretty much across the country. And I don't know about Canada, but I just want to say I downloaded it day one, bitches. And that's why I don't fuck around with retail whenever I can avoid it.
So to me, the difference in this game is that, well, so I'd much rather get a retail copy because, A, they're not giving me a discount. If they were giving me a discount...
The discount is I got to play it about 4 days early. Plus, if I had some digital deluxe shit from Wii, I could use it on that too.
Can you... Oh, that's right, because you can use the points across if you still have
them. That's right.
So this comes to a point, though. I know Nintendo wants me to buy these games digitally. I get that. Their profit margin is way higher. They need to give me some reason to do it.
Yeah. Well, this week kind of got the ball rolling, don't you think? Yeah.
That is a shitty fucking reason.
Some people were, you know, having conspiracy theories about Nintendo intentionally delaying shipments.
I joked about it.
You have to wonder.
It would be no. If they were going to do that, it'd be Pokemon.
Oh God.
It certainly doesn't hurt their cause in terms of driving people onto the eShop. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean their profit margin must be astronomical. Compared to selling a retail copy.
Yep.
Like multiple times higher because A, they're not selling it at a wholesale price, and B, there's nothing physical for them to produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've done a much better job in Japan of promoting that stuff, of explaining to the mainstream consumer why you would want to buy it digitally. And then they're also giving people, I think it's about a 10% break on the price for most games. And they're just not doing that here in America. And I mean, I still think there are lots of benefits to buying it digitally, even in America. But I don't know if price is the only way to do it, but I feel like they need to probably incentivize. Cause if you buy stuff at retail, they give you all kinds of incentives. You know, you get a free art book from GameStop or whatever. I mean, there should be, and that's not intrinsic to the retail thing. That's something they're throwing in addition to the game. And I feel like if you buy it digitally, you should get something in addition to the game to help counterbalance those incentives. And, you know, I think the way it's done on Wii U is pretty good with the 10% back, because it's not a break on that game. They can still sell that game for full price, but it's the promise of some future discount that you can get on something else of your choice. I think that's a totally fine way to do it. There are other options, but on 3DS, it's a little arguable. Then on the other hand, because 3DS is a portable system, having the game built into the system is really nice.
Yeah.
And for Pokemon, it's going to be huge.
The counter for that, though, is I like the fact that my save is secured on the cartridge. So if something were to happen to my system, I'd still have all my saves and all my games and all that stuff set up.
Are you totally sure about that? Because I thought a lot of 3DS, even retail cartridge games, like, don't they have extra data that they save to the internal memory?
Maybe, but I've swapped games with people and they've had my game saves.
Okay, so maybe the extra data is... I don't know. But maybe it's not just the standard save file, it's something else.
I'm pretty sure that every 3DS cartridge has memory, like four saves.
Yeah, so I did end up having to buy it digitally, which I was not pleased about. However, I did game the system a little bit by buying it at Best Buy and getting Best Buy reward points. What I would like to see is I'd like to see the same sort of premium setup that the Wii U has on the 3DS, but I'd like to see even more is to be able to have one singular wallet of points between my 3DS and my Wii U. That would be tremendously helpful, because then I get rewards on purchases on both systems, and they would feed back into themselves.
It seems like the kind of thing they could maybe do after the fact, you know, at some point in the future, because it's all on their side. I don't think the point systems aren't built into the hardware on either one of these platforms. So it seems like something they just got to get their shit together on the server side and, you know, make those systems talk to each other and share the same pool. Because I think Sony does that between PS3 and Vita.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It would be nice to just, if I had points on my 3DS and have some left over from a purchase, I could buy something on the Wii U.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not there.
If there was something to buy on the Wii U.
To be fair, Fist of the North Star came out. So there is something to buy on the Wii U.
Well, Runner 2 was submitted for certification, so Runner 2 will be out within a couple of weeks, and that's a very good game. That's a game that you will want.
Anyway, let's get to the game.
Please.
So Fire Emblem Awakening. I was really glowing on this game because I thought the demo was really, really good, and it turns out that, it's a really solid Fire Emblem game. I mean, it's a Fire Emblem game in and of itself, so there's not... If you know the franchise, there's not a whole lot to go into on that front. It doesn't evolve the core gameplay mechanics appreciably in any real direction, with the exception of perhaps the ability to partner characters and their relationship stuff.
Well, those core mechanics have been around since basically 1990, right? Like the first NES game.
Forever.
Yeah.
So, it's those core mechanics are still the same game you played. Well, you didn't play it, but... people in Japan play 1990. So with that in mind, I wanted to discuss a bit about, you know, how this game feels divorced from the fact that it is effectively the same game, or in much the same game. I spoke last week that the presentation looked really, really good, and it does. There's a lot of really nice art. The character models in battle look pretty good. The music is quite nice. The sound effects seem pretty decent. The voice stuff, there is voice. I just wish they actually said what they were saying on the thing. We talked about that last week. But what I really like about the game is that it feels like it's got a nice pace to it, which is good, because a lot of times strategy games can feel kind of plodding. I mean, there's very little that I'm not happy about with the game so far. I mean, I've reached chapter 12 in a few days, which is reasonably far into the game. I think there's 40. Or something like that. So I'm making decent progress. I've been doing a lot of the optional missions. I did the first DLC, which was cool. It's just, you fight characters from Fire Emblem history, and if you win, you get to take possession of one of them to have in your party. So I've got the legendary hero Marth. It's not actually Marth. It's a magical incantation that brings a representation of him to the battlefield.
Hmm.
He's kind of awesome, I have to say.
Does he integrate into the story at all? I mean, and not just in the way that they explain the existence of this character, but like, does he participate in cutscenes and things like that?
No, because he's not Marth. They actually come out and say, this isn't Marth. This card has the ability to summon what is essentially a living weapon.
Yeah, that would be a problem since Martha's kind of figures into the story of the main game, right?
Well, Martha's been dead for hundreds of years when this game comes around.
But he is referenced heavily in this game's story, right?
Well, there's a character named Marth. That is not the Marth.
Okay, so there's a character named Marth, but he's not the Marth, and there's also a card that summons the mystical hero Marth, but also he's not Marth.
Yes.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah. Well, no, the character that named Marth is named after the historical king, Marth.
I hope you can also, do a DLC that will let you win the Smash Brothers version of Marth.
There you go. Yeah.
He can be, on a trophy.
There you go. He just stands there. What has been really actually entertaining about the game is just the writing is so good. It's surprisingly good. A lot of the character interactions are really, really funny. So I had the strategist, which is your avatar in the game. I had partnered him up with the female lead. I guess you'd call her the female lead. I mean, the main character's sister.
Lyssa.
Yeah, Lyssa. I did that because the stat boost you get, a little interesting tidbit on this game, the stat boost you get is deterministic based on who you've partnered with who. So in her case, she boosted the magic and luck stats of my already HP really powerful but luck deprived magic wielding strategist and essentially turned him into an unbeatable killing machine. But the neat thing is he gets 1.5 experience if he fights with the partner. So he shot through the levels just because she followed him around in battle all the time. And by having her with him and him basically being unkillable, I could have her near the front lines without any real risk to her safety.
Now the guy you're talking about is your avatar. He's basically the James character.
He's the most overpowered Fire Emblem character ever.
Oh really? He's more so. I thought Fred. As we learned from when we did Sacred Stones, every Fire Emblem, or at least the modern ones, they always give you a really powerful character in your party at the beginning who you probably shouldn't use because they'll steal experience from everyone else. And I thought Frederick must be. Because he's the guy on the horse, he's extra mobile, and...
He is that character, he is. And you get other horsemen later who aren't as sophisticated and powerful as Frederick. And of course, the downside of that character is their ceiling is pretty close to where they start. You can't progress them but so far. The uniqueness of the strategist, your avatar character, is that they wield magic really effectively. And they're also a very good swordsman. And if you level them up a lot, they almost always get to do 2 attacks on a lot of enemies. And it doesn't matter what type of – which skill set you're using, they're probably going to kill that enemy. It's an interesting combination because usually wizards are really frail in the Fire Emblem games.
Yeah. But your avatar character can use magic and swords.
Right.
So I think he's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah, and he ends up being ridiculous. So I got him all the way up to the max level, which is 20, before anybody else got past 15 just because of that double experience.
Mm-hmm.
Or 1.5 experience. And then I classed him up and he's now moving into the next class, which is awesome.
So I know that you can, by pairing up these characters and developing their familiarity with each other, in some cases you can make them enter a relationship and eventually have a child. Is that possible with your avatar character also?
It is. So my avatar character is married to Lyssa.
Really?
Not deliberately. So I really enjoyed...
Not deliberately. She got pregnant and really pressured him to, own up and be a man.
Outside of battle, there's this choice called support. And as characters, interact each other on the battlefield, or sometimes they gain familiarity just from story events, you'll gain access to what are essentially support cutscenes between 2 characters. And because they spent so much time together, her basically being his experience and stat multiplier, and him basically being her shield when we needed to have a healer on the front line. They went all the way through all the sets, and I got all the way to S, which is the last level of their support level. Because I'd really enjoyed their exchanges. Basically, she would pull pranks on him and he'd overreact. It was this really enjoyable set of funny sequences. And then they did the last one, and she was talking about she wasn't going to prank him anymore, but in exchange, that meant she had to go take all the frogs back to the pond.
Is that a euphemism?
No, she literally intended to drop a bunch of frogs on him. And at the end, he proposed to her. I'm like, oops. Oh, well.
So it's not like in Mass Effect where they make you work really hard to get right up to the brink of consummating a relationship. And then once you do, it almost says like, yes or no, do you want to have sex with this person? So it sounds like in Fire Emblem, it's a little bit more natural. And then all of a sudden you find out, oh, these characters were taking this situation a little more seriously than I, as the viewer, interpreted it to be.
Yeah. So what I found is I have a couple of characters who I've really started to enjoy their interaction. And I'm making an active effort to move them along. And not necessarily, you know, male-female partnerships. There are male characters who have funny exchanges that I've tried to get them up because I find them to be actually really funny.
Matchmaker.
Yeah, I know.
Who would have expected this element to be brought into the Fire Emblem series?
That's just crazy. It's awesome.
So I've already gone through the marriage thing twice now. One of them, it's really easy. Because she's basically falling all over the main character from the very beginning. Literally. It doesn't take very much. Like, I had them together for a couple missions because she was really helpful. And, like, that was it. It was done. I was like, well, that was quick.
I feel like all this might be getting pretty confusing if people haven't actually played. If you played the demo, then actually it'll probably sort a lot of this stuff out in terms of the avatar character versus the main character versus the guy who looks like Marth, but we're not sure if he's really Marth because he wears a mask and he's from... popped out of some portal. So James, do you feel that the tone of the game has changed a lot versus other Fire Emblems? I've heard that there's some sci-fi elements and...
There are. There are zombies.
Yeah, you see those in the demo, in one of those awesome, you know, movies that they play.
Yeah, you see, there's a lot of time is spent, you have the normal story battles, and those don't tend to evolve the name they use for the zombies. Occasionally, one will pop up on the main map. Like, you'll see one just standing next to a battle site. And you can walk over there and engage in an on-story battle against them.
Hmm.
And sometimes they're really hard. Sometimes they are legitimately difficult battles. And sometimes they're just like, beep, 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 done. But they're good for experience. You know, they let you level characters up outside of the main battle flow. So they're helpful in that respect. It is a little bit more sci-fi-ish. The characters are funnier than they've been in any Fire Emblem game in the past. I mean...
That could just be 8-4. I mean, our friends over at 8-4 localized this game, and they're getting rave reviews from almost everybody.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the dialogue is really, really funny. I mean, like I said, I ended up with Lisa and your avatar together in part because I thought her pranks on him were hilarious. Because they just kept coming and becoming more creative. But... It's a very well put together kind of game. I'm really pleased with it. One thing I want to talk about is that I did choose to play on the hardest difficulty setting, but I went and played it in, I'm going to get hate for this. I went and actually played it in casual mode.
You've changed, man.
No, well, hold on. If
you used to be street.
If I lose characters early in the battle, I reset. But if I'm towards the very end of the battle, and somebody gets whacked from behind or something ridiculous, I'm not going to beat myself up over it anymore because I don't have to. I still punish myself for being reckless. I still restart the chapter unless it's towards the very end. And I go, okay, well, it is what it is. But if I start losing characters left and right, even if I've already won the battle, I'm going to restart it. I've taken the absolute worst punishment out of the game. But I've kept enough of it there to make up for it. And I'm playing it on a harder difficulty setting. So I'm giving myself an advantage, but I'm also putting the odds up higher.
See, I kind of took the opposite tact, and I'm still really, really early in the game. I mean, I haven't actually caught up to the end of the demo in the real game, but I went ahead and did classic mode, which is where if your characters die and you complete the battle, then they're dead forever. But I'm playing it on normal difficulty, which says it's for beginners, and I'm not really a beginner. I've played another Fire Emblem and Advance Wars, and I'm about to finish XCOM Enemy Unknown. So I figured, like, I don't want to be super stressed out when I play this game, so I don't necessarily want to play it on a really hard difficulty level, but I kind of want a little bit of that pressure that you get from the classic Fire Emblem, you know, permadeath scheme.
I checked out the harder difficulty on the demo just to see what it was, and it seemed to be only that you're going to miss more and the enemies are going to miss less. I'm not sure how that's fun.
That sounds really irritating, yeah.
Well, I mean, so speaking of Fire Emblem statistics a little bit, I was talking about this with Guillaume before we we started recording. Mm-hmm. In general, when you're playing a Fire Emblem game, you'll reach a point where if you look at the map before the enemy starts, you can pretty much play out in your head everything that's going to happen. Because the enemies don't act strategically. They act very tactically based on a very simple set of guidelines, which is primarily, who can I hurt the most that's in my attack radius? It's mm-hmm. in no way self-preservational, and it isn't driven in any mechanism to effectively complete the objective of the game, which is prevent you from proceeding. It's solely driven on what the next exchange of combat's going to be. So a lot of times you can bait enemies into attacking people they have no chance against. That's a relatively effective strategy for managing risk. So I mentioned that the Avatar character is stupid powerful. And he has really high evasion. So a lot of times I'll walk him right into the main thoroughfare of a battle, knowing that he'll draw enemies around him, and then just let other people come in afterwards and clean up the mess around him to get experience.
Yeah, you've been playing too much Last Story.
A little bit.
You're just turning on the aggro and...
Essentially, yeah. I mean, I'm essentially gaming the fact that I know they're going to go after whoever they think they have the best chance against, even if they have no chance against that person because he's the only option.
That's a common strategy in Fire Emblem games. Like we mentioned the tank character that's really powerful at the beginning. You always use him usually to bait the characters into getting just in range of your other characters so they can finish them off.
Yeah, and the thing is, I've actually deliberately not gotten good weapons on the Avatar character. I'll equip a bad weapon because otherwise he'll kill the shit out of them.
Yep.
So I had one chapter where I marched him right to the middle of the main thoroughfare, and the enemies just kept walking right up to him, getting their ass beat, and he just stood there, dead, dead. I'm like, oh, this is ridiculous. And then, like, there was no experience left for anybody else. He just stood there and massacred people. It was it was really unfair. It was like he was the last boss of the game.
So, James, I know that you're really good at this kind of game, and you've played a lot of them, but considering you're playing on the hardest difficulty level, and it sounds like you're having a pretty easy time with it, does that concern you a little bit, or do you think there's enough progression and maybe, like, bonus content that will satisfy someone like you who's a pretty high-level player?
So if I include the special chapters that are not part of the main game that unlock as you progress, I've played, I'd say, roughly 16 battles in about 8 hours, I guess. So it's not like I'm blazing through it, but I'm enjoying it enough that I think losing the constant need to reset at the end of battles has made my enjoyment of the game higher. 'Cause, I mean, it's not uncommon in a Fire Emblem game for you to let your guard down late in the battle.
Yeah.
And what I found is this game compensates for that by making it less about killing the enemy boss, which is what a lot of the Fire Emblem games are about. And what a lot of strategy RPGs are about. So, you know, the Ogre Battle game, Tactics Ogre, it was always kill the last boss, kill the boss, kill the boss, kill the boss. And in these games, really most of the battles in Awakening are, they say rout the enemy. Which essentially means massacre every last one of these bastards. Mm-hmm. You end up spending a lot of time just, you know, doing cleanup duty. And that means you do have to kind of manage risk even to the very late part of the battle. So I get some challenge out of it in sort of managing risk at that point. It is easier because I'm not having to restart all the time. But a lot of the chapters where you have to rescue someone, that's incessant restarting. Because a lot of times the AI you're trying to rescue is a complete moron.
Yeah.
So there's a character you get called Naoi late in the – or about chapter 10. And she comes with essentially a handler. So there's two characters together. But she looks like an 11-year-old girl. She's 1,000, by the way, because that's what they do in these games. But she's 11. She's not dressed appropriately at all for being 11. But she's 1,000. So they have this conversation. She goes, no, I'm 1,000 years old. It's okay. I can do this. It's like, no, it's not okay. But in the chapter where you actually get direct control over her at the very beginning, which is fine, so it's really easy to handle her, and you can more or less guide her out of danger. But right before that, you unlock a bonus chapter where you gain access to a character, and she runs right into the teeth of the enemy at the very beginning, and you have to go all out to rescue her. Like, you really have to just play the game just stupidly aggressive to have any chance of getting to her in time. And I had to reset God knows how many times. The LR and start became like my default button press for the entire playthrough. Which, if you don't know, that restarts the game.
It's a useful combination to know when playing Fire Emblem.
And the funny thing is, there's no way to get to the main menu. In Awakening, there's no direct jump to main menu button.
I mean, you could always go to the home screen and close.
Yeah, but you can't just exit to the main menu, which is annoying. But yeah, I mean, I'm still getting my requisite number of resets. It's just, I'm not getting them at that very last phase of the battle where I miscount the number of steps an enemy can take and they get the drop on like a level 5 mage I'm trying to level up.
Yeah.
It's self-preservational for my own sanity, and because I just don't have time to do this anymore. I don't really have time to throw hundreds of uncounted hours into the game because I lost, you know, Ike got his shit wrecked by some dude. Now, granted, if Crom dies or the strategist dies, you still have to restart the game, or it'll restart the chapter.
But that's a forced restart. Yeah.
Right.
That means you really screwed up real bad.
Do not kill story characters. Don't do it.
Yeah, please.
But actually, you can kill Lyssa. That's okay for some reason.
That's the thing. Like, all the characters are story characters in some sense, but, you know, some are more critical than others. Some of them appear in the expensive anime 3D movies later in the game, and you have to make sure that you don't break the fiction by those people dying.
The funny thing is, they never actually die in the old Fire Emblem games. They're just badly wounded.
Right. Can't fight anymore.
They'll pop up in cutscenes sometimes, badly wounded. They may even say, "I'd love to help, but I'm just too injured." It's so weird.
Usually with a frown on their face.
It's such weird metafiction.
It's G-rated.
Yeah, it is. I'm considering the sheer number of deaths my party is responsible for. You would think that they would be less sheepish about one of our characters dying, because we killed a lot of fucking people already. We are on a kill streak unlike any other.
We better move on, James. I know you're going to be talking about this next week probably, and a lot of us will be. I hope to be playing it and talking about it more soon, too.
It's really cool. I'm really happy with it. And I have to say, don't feel like a bitch if you decide to play it in, quote, casual mode. It's a legitimate way to play the game. It really is.
Casual for Fire Emblem is a relative term.
Yeah. It's not super easy. I mean, you can't play like a moron. You'll lose the battle. But you can be a little bit more aggressive. You don't have to be super duper concerned with every minute detail of enemy movement. Although, if you beat this game, you'll probably learn to figure it out anyway.
All right, so moving on to John.
All right, I got my copy of Hyrule Historia last week.
Last year. John has a time machine.
I had it that early. I got a little early printing of it. But I opened it up, amazingly enough, unwrapped it. So, you know, it's always a monumentous occasion in this household.
And the church bells rang.
Yep. And I got to say, I'm pretty happy with it. Actually, I set aside a couple of hours to go through it because I knew. I mean, it's a lot of in-depth information.
It's so beefy.
Yeah, it really is. There's a ton of information. Too much to really – I mean, it'll take you weeks to go through it really in any sort of depth. But it's interesting. It's broken up into three parts. The first part is mainly Skyward Sword, all kinds of stuff, you know, talking about each area in the game, what inspired it, talking to the devs and what they have to say about each area and lots of concept art, you know, what went into the thinking of each character, like what, you know, why each character is designed the way they are.
Does it kind of feel like the book is 1 year late?
No, not really, because they go into what, in terms of Skyward Sword?
Yeah.
It is, but that's okay. I mean, that's just happens to be the last game that came out, you know, the last major game, so.
Are they making this book for the Japanese release when Skyward Sword was probably wrapping up development?
That's kind of where my question was coming from. Like, does it feel like kind of a promotional tool for a game that already came and went a year ago?
No, because there's so much other info in this book. It's just a ton of information about every single game in the series, the timeline, all kinds of stuff like that, so.
Yeah, there's a lot of really, I mean, especially for Skyward Sword, there's a lot of really cool, like, you could see how characters evolved as they, from their initial design to where they ended up.
Yeah. You know, they'll go through every single sketch they've ever made of the character. You know, kind of stuff that was pitched but rejected, which is really interesting. Or characters that they completely fleshed out and designed but just never made it into the game for whatever reason. They just didn't think, maybe they just didn't fit into the story or whatever. There's some really cool stuff like that.
And there's a great two-page spread about Birdo. No, that's Nintendo Force.
There is a great half-page spread about Tingle, about who is Tingle. And my favorite part is that they go into all this detail about Tingle, which is absolutely hilarious because it shows you how much thought they've actually put into the Tingle character.
Oh, they put a ton of thought into Tingle.
And the best thing is they show him with his hat off and his shirt off.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so they say that his chest hair is quite thick, by the way, if you were wondering. Tingle's chest hair is quite thick, and his hair looks like it was done by his grandmother. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Kulu Limpa.
One of my favorite, there's two things I really liked. One of them was the milk bar in Skyward Sword, which was unused.
Mm-hmm.
They did. I guess the milk bar just doesn't make it into the game. It's just part of the pumpkin. They just replaced it with Pumpkin Landing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The owner has cow legs and a tail. And is a very masculine looking woman with a crown made of milk bottles.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yes. And one thing I thought was interesting with the pumpkin landing is Kena, all the steps they took for Kena. She looks like a totally different character at one point.
Yeah.
But I never realized that Pumpkin Landing's inside is shaped like a pumpkin until they had a picture of it and they're like, whoa, everything in that stage is pumpkin shaped.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
But are we just going to gloss over the fact that there was almost a, you know, character that you drank the milk of?
Well, I'm not saying she produced her own milk.
She did have cow legs. I don't know.
She has like cow leggings on or something. She's cow colored. It's weird. It's a weird character.
But she's not part cow.
No, she doesn't have actual cow's legs.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
But she's got like human legs that are cow pattern, and she has a tail. It's bizarre.
Huh.
She's a bizarre looking character.
Yeah. But in terms of the timeline is kind of, I guess, the thing that's going to probably spark the most controversy. It's pretty interesting, and the way they have it laid out, you can pretty much tell that they can do whatever they want with the timeline. It's extremely loose the way they have it set. So the way it breaks down is, it's all along one single timeline, starting with Skyward Sword. That's the first game in the series, allegedly, time-wise.
Right. Even though Skyward Sword has a huge section about that is essentially stuff from the past.
And then it goes Minish Cap, and then Four Swords. That's kind of the chronicle of the evil Vati. The rise,
yes.
And, you know, his return.
The rise and fall of Vati.
Yep. Then it goes Ocarina of Time. And then at that point, how Ocarina of Time ends for the player determines whether or not it splits into one of three different timelines. So you have the first timeline being if you lose at the end of Ocarina of Time.
It takes you back to the title screen.
Well, yes.
Game over.
But no, wait, Johnny. There's much more than that. There's much more than that.
Ugh.
If that happens, unbeknownst to you, you may just go back to the title screen, but unbeknownst to you in the background is actually the decline of Hyrule and the Last Hero, which splits off into A Link to the Past, and then after that, Oracle of Ages, those two games, and then Link's Awakening, and then the original game and Adventure of Link, right? So that's if you lose in Ocarina of Time, right? So unbeknownst to you, even though you may have just like maybe you had just, you know, a bad game, you know, maybe you looked the other way and you died. A lot of shit happened because of that. So just take that to heart.
Maybe you got to the water temple and quit.
What's funny is, so at some point after Link's Awakening, somehow Link killing a dream god manages to allow the monarchs of Hyrule to retake the Triforce and restore the kingdom.
Yep.
Don't know why.
Yep.
Just happens.
Now, the other ones are the two other timelines are if the hero is triumphant, and they're split into whether or not Link is a child or an adult.
Again, at the end of the game, he becomes a child again.
Right. Yeah.
So they're presenting that there's a bifurcation here where there is none.
Well, there's two timelines. So I guess what they're saying is child Link.
Well, no, there's not, because in Ocarina, Link is one guy who goes back and mm-hmm. forth. So when he skips ahead to the future and becomes an adult, he didn't exist during those 7 years in between.
So maybe they're saying Child Link goes back and like, hey Ganon, what? Boom! And that's it.
Yeah. So anyways, the one timeline is Majora's Mask, Twilight Princess, and Four Swords. And then the other one is Wind Waker, Phantom Hourglass, and Spirit Tracks.
The funny part about the child version of it is they fucking execute Ganon in that one. They're like, no, we've had enough of this.
Yeah.
You're done. And the other one, they just seal him. Like, whatever. You just go away.
Yep.
So apparently the king of Hyrule, when young Link comes around and goes, dude, this guy's for serious. Not very forgiving. Apparently incredibly forgiving if after he's already wrecked everything.
So I guess the thing that interests me about this whole thing is not, you know, whatever some guy at Nintendo said was the order that the games took place in, but it's really, and this is aside from the book itself, but in terms of the franchise, it's weird to me that as time goes on, it seems like the general trend for Nintendo is that they want to go farther and farther back, and they're always, especially, you know, Skyward Sword is really blatant about this, but they're always trying to explain the origins of how all this stuff came to be. And I would understand, that's really interesting, like once, but they've tried to do that like six times. Yes. And at some point, isn't it maybe also interesting, maybe even more interesting to say what happened after the game that you played before? Like, what is the next step? What is the new danger that comes and presents itself to a Hyrule that's already been saved by Link? And I thought, you know, like in Wind Waker, that was easily the most interesting part of that entire game, was going under the ocean and seeing the old Hyrule castle and realizing that this has all happened before and that you are kind of the reincarnation. And that had been, I think, kind of implied in other Zelda games, but they'd never really done it like that. And to think that, you know, it's kind of that water world effect. It's like you go back up there and you look at the way Hyrule is now with this giant ocean and you realize that this is the essentially post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm, right.
Like it lends this weird kind of sci-fi element to it. And it's like, wow, there is maybe a way for me to save the world and take it back to kind of the way that it used to be. But in doing so, I'm also going to lose the way it is now, which is very, especially in Wind Waker, so beautiful and captivating. So I think there's something a little more bittersweet about that. And Majora's Mask is the same way. It's like, this is a kid who's already saved the world and now he's being dragged into this totally other doomsday scenario that's even more harrowing probably than the first time. And the emotional and psychological toll that it must be taking on the hero in that game, I think, is conveyed to the player in the whole tone that we just talked about a couple of weeks ago. So to me, that's the more interesting direction for the whole franchise, is to go forward and not backward as they always do.
Actually, I just was just looking at it right now. So actually, Demon Thief Ganondorf is executed, happens after Majora's Mask. Maybe Link's so pissed off from having to save another world, he goes, you know what? No. That's it. Everybody's getting killed now. And just goes back.
He goes down in the dungeons and just
beats the shit out of him.
You're too dangerous to live, Ganon.
He's like, look, I stopped a moon and a god, and I brought the fierce deity mask back. Your ass is mine. That's how it goes down.
Yep. Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other cool stuff in here, too. There's, like, neat that shows, like, the graph sheets that they use to actually you know, plan out like the rooms and stuff in the earlier games. Just really, really cool stuff. And like what I like too is that they have a lot of the artwork from the earlier games, like the early games, the first games in the series, that you really don't see a lot of, because a lot of that stuff was only, you really only saw that stuff, at least in the West, in the actual game manuals themselves. Very tiny. And really, I mean, back in like the mid 80s, there was really no art book industry kind of thing. There was really no way to get your hands on that artwork. I mean, Japan back in the day was pretty hard to get anything really out of Japan at that time. Really, that's pretty recent. That, you know, I mean, now you can get all kinds of, you know, you can order any game you want from Japan, order all kinds of books, all kinds of comics.
Before the internet, it was hard to import anything.
It was very hard to get access to really anything from Japan. So that kind of stuff really interested me. Just kind of seeing like this, you know, just kind of random pieces of concept art and, you know, just, you know, art, you know, game manual art that otherwise you wouldn't have seen. So it's a really good book. I mean, there's a comic at the end that it's all about Skyward Sword. So I haven't read through that all the way yet, but yeah, it's really good. I mean, if you're a fan of the franchise, it's a no-brainer. It is awesome.
If you remember in Skyward Sword, somebody figured out how to read the thing that was behind Link on the logo. whatever it was that was supposed to be behind him. It is interesting that they actually print the entire alphabet for the various Zelda timelines. So, like, the sign over Kakariko Village actually says exactly that if you translate out the text they've got. Oh, it says in Japanese, yep. Kakariko Mura, but still, it's kind of neat.
Yeah, they really go into – and it's that kind of detail that is in there for every game.
It's funny that they put that into the game because they never actually released the alphabet before.
Yeah.
It's like, what was the point of this? Why did you do this? Well, they just did.
Yeah. That's the way I would describe this book is pointless detail.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, if there's answers to questions you never even would have thought of asking about the franchise. So in that respect, it's really, really good.
It's actually more in the nature of, like, there are details you'd have never expected are in there to even begin to ask. It's just like, hey, yeah. Look at all the shit we did you never even noticed, you ungrateful bastards.
That's really cool, though.
It's not too often that you see something like this where they just pretty much took everything that they knew about this game series and just barfed it out into this book. Like, stuff that they didn't even really have to release. Like, this is, you know, a sketch of this character. And here, you know, this character didn't even make it into the game, but here's every single thing we ever pitched about it, and here's why we did it, and here's so-and-so's commentary on what they were thinking. It's just all this just random info just tossed into this book. So it's really cool. I mean, if you like the franchise, I mean, you'll love it.
It actually, there's a whole page devoted just so, if you remember at the beginning of Twilight Princess, you see the scene where those sages kill Ganondorf. That really kind of, like, what the fuck scene where they summon, like, magic swords and just slam all through his body. They spend a whole page just discussing the nature of that scene.
Yeah, like, it would be really cool to actually play through each game with this book beside you so you could just kind of refer to things as you play through them. Because it would be like...
A commentary track.
Yeah, a commentary track or, like, pop-up video or something like that while you're playing through, just because there's so many, like, random tidbits about the characters in each game. And, you know, we designed this certain area a certain way because we wanted to evoke this feeling.
It's a really neat book.
Yep, it's great. And the one cool thing about Tingle is that I don't know if this is ever actually shown anywhere because he's always either up in the air or has, like, his backpack on. But on the back of his little tunic or jacket or whatever is a golden cobra. Like a cobra ready to strike.
It's weird.
And it's supposedly to scare away enemies.
Yes.
Because wow. I guess his whole deal is that he just travels around making maps. Like, so he flies over areas mapping it out, and that's what he does.
Right. He needs to be kept safe from enemies.
Tingle, fascinating guy.
So I'm up next with new business, and oh look, a wild TYP has appeared. So Michael Cole is here. He's visiting here in Colorado on a business trip, and we got to hang out last weekend and play a bunch of Wii U multiplayer, and he just stepped in and sat down. So now we're doing the podcast together.
Sweet.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about our experiences playing Wii U because it was – probably the best multiplayer session I've had on Wii U.
Yeah, same for me.
So we start out actually the night before we had gotten the news over Twitter that Best Buy had copies of Call of Duty Black Ops 2 for $30 on Wii U. And I said, okay, well, I'm not getting a better deal than that on the eShop, even if they ever do release it. So I went out and picked a copy of that. And we plugged in. You know, I think we were both curious to try the so-called split-screen multiplayer. And the first time we played only basically a local match, only the two of us against each other. And as you might expect, it was like, you know, the map was way too big and we always constantly trying to figure out where the other guy was. TYP actually bested me in that series, I think. And then from there
which is scary because I suck ass at first person shooters. Well,
but it's literally the first time either of us had played this game, and so we didn't know what the weapons were. Mm. We didn't really know what was going on.
Well, one interesting observation I think we made was that because I was playing on the gamepad screen, you were on the TV, there was kind of an asymmetric cheating going on where I could look up and see where you were and you couldn't see where I was.
That's true. So I might have to, like, if we do, if we play some more after recording tonight, I might have to make you go in the other room. No, that's very true. I was kind of hoping that you'd be able to play through the campaign co-op, but it doesn't seem that that's available. I guess Call of Duty doesn't really have two-player co-op all the way through the whole game like Halo does, but I was kind of looking forward to that. I think that would be a lot more fun, but we did go online after that and did Team Deathmatch online. So we're both playing through my Wii U on separate screens, and we're also playing with all these other people on the internet. And that worked really well. I mean, it was easy to set up.
Mm-hmm.
It was fast. There was no major lag or anything like that.
Yeah, we didn't notice any problems.
And it was very smooth. And, you know, we were probably – I mean, I think you took last and I took – the third to last. So neither of us knew what we were doing, but I felt like, although most of the other players were better than us, it wasn't like ridiculous, you know, just take it. It wasn't like playing Counter-Strike in the mid 90s. It wasn't like you take a step and you die. Most of the time you had a chance to run around. I had plenty of kills, you know, which always surprises me. I mean, I guess I'm okay at first person shooters, but anytime I get a kill online, I always feel like, whoa, I just got away with stealing something because I just assume that everyone else is better than me.
Yeah. Now, I didn't hear any voice chat at all while we played. Was that because of a setting you made, or?
Well, no, it's because I think the only way you hear voice chat is if you plug a headset into the gamepad. I think that's primarily the way that you would do it. So you actually could have done it. And I tried it a little bit on Assassin's Creed 3 when I first downloaded that. And it works fine. Basically, it works really well if you have an iPhone headset that has a microphone built into the cord because it, you know, there's no USB, of course, on the gamepad. So you have to plug in a quarter or an eighth inch jack. But if you have something like that, it works really well. I think probably if you have one of those, didn't they sell some for Pokemon on DS?
Yeah, the headset. It wasn't explicitly for Pokemon, but it was the only game that used it, I think.
But did that have a special jack?
It might have.
So basically you need something with an integrated mic on a eighth inch jack, which is a standard headphone jack, but they're very common. Yeah. They're very easy to find.
You can get plenty of them at Best Buy. Yeah, including one that's like the Turtle Beach gaming headset or whatever.
You don't need that. I mean, you can get one for super cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally used one that had been lying around because I think Apple's headphones are pretty terrible.
Yeah.
So I don't use it for anything else, but I was like, oh, for the gamepad is perfect. And so normally I just keep it on the table in case I happen to want to use that. But yeah, we didn't mess around with voice chat. It worked really well. I mean, we only played it for like 20 minutes probably because Mike wasn't – once we get over the curiosity factor, Mike was like, okay, I've had enough Call of Duty.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was a great deal you got for it. And the fact that I passed it up says a lot. I mean, $30 for like basically a brand new game on a new system.
Yeah. With some really cool features.
Yeah.
I was definitely curious to try that stuff, especially while I had you here.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed at how well that stuff worked. And if you have – you know, if you live with someone who's a big Call of Duty fan, or if you have friends locally who really like to play Call of Duty with you, this is a pretty awesome feature to have in this version of the game, to be able to bring them over and you both play together in the same room, but you don't have to split the screen on the TV.
Right.
It's big. It's really cool.
How did it play on the pad? Was there any lag or was there anything like that?
No, I didn't notice any lag. I didn't notice any issue with the frame rate. It seemed pretty good. I mean, I bumped up the brightness from like the second to lowest setting down to the second, to the second to highest setting. But it's a dark game.
Yeah. And I think I had it knocked down because I'd been watching Netflix on it a lot. And for Netflix, you kind of want it. Yeah. You want the battery to last longer. And also the brightness kind of washes out a lot of movies, but, it's easy enough to fix, you know.
Yeah, it's funny because I was curious about this and I checked out on YouTube, you know, just to see what it actually looked like when somebody was playing it on the pad. And the funniest thing was the comments underneath, because I mean, it looked really good and everybody underneath was like, there's no way that's real. There's no way that's real. That's fake. It's fake. Totally fake.
I could not perceive any difference on what, like the quality of what Johnny was looking at versus quality. Now they might dumb down the graphics on both a little bit to support it. I don't know, but it looked smooth as butter.
Yeah.
And I would not know if they dumbed it down a little
bit. It ran very smoothly on the TV. I mean, that's the only one I could see. But it looked sharp. I mean, I haven't played the solo mode, so I don't know what it looks like when you don't have two people doing it. but I thought it looked great, and most importantly, it ran smoothly, which is the most important thing for a shooter.
Nintendo should be masquerading this shit out like crazy, and people don't believe it. They need to show people, this is awesome, this is local multiplayer the way it should be. Yeah. I mean,
I'm hoping they're going to have some kind of, you know, kind of premier shooter at E3. Like, I don't know if the Metroid is the right franchise to show this off, but something, you know, whether it's third party or otherwise, but something to kind of do this and do it at least as well, if not better.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I mean, this is what you would like. I mean, this is a high quality third party first person shooter. It came out not quite day and date with the other versions because the system launched like a couple weeks later, but at practically the same time, it has apparently really good online multiplayer, and it has all these features that the other systems don't even have. Like, this is the third party game that Nintendo should be kind of
championing.
Yeah, really. Cause I mean, I was just immediately impressed with it. Immediately.
Yeah. And I mean, they really didn't really talk about it very much at all from what I saw. It was just like, yep, we got to have, you know, Black Ops 2. Anyways, moving on.
Yeah, well, we have to move on, too, because we only played it for a few minutes. But it was a cool experience. I'm looking forward to doing more of it later on. So the next thing, we played The Cave for a couple minutes, and I found a reproducible bug in the multiplayer for The Cave, because I'd actually tried it a few days earlier with someone else who was over visiting. There's the infamous minecart puzzle in the game. There's a section where you have to basically put one character in a minecart and have another push him off the screen. And then it takes you to this other sort of, you know, off to the side area where you're supposed to do something. And we could only get it to work about half the time.
I'd say less than half the time.
Yeah. Cause the camera is just so spastic, you know, I mean, even when you play multiplayer in The Cave, you only ever have one camera. It never goes split screen. And it's not really clear who's the focus. It seems to kind of shift around.
It's not like New Super Mario Brothers Wii or Wii U where it'll kind of zoom out, you know, a decent amount.
The camera doesn't zoom around.
It doesn't do anything like that. So.
And plus you're both switching among these three characters, and one of the characters might be over here, and so that every time you switch, the camera may or may not pan over to the new character you just switched to. It's very confusing, and not only is it confusing, but when we were dealing with this puzzle that involves kind of a scripted event to happen, if the camera doesn't follow to the scripted part of the scene, you can't do the puzzle. And as far as I can tell, this puzzle is virtually impossible to play in multiplayer. And I did it, by the way, later on, I went back by myself and I did it in single player. But don't play The Cave in multiplayer, really. It's not, it just doesn't work.
They shouldn't have included the feature.
It does not work.
It's broken.
Yeah. The Cave is a little bit messy, even in single player, but in multi, it seems like a natural fit, but it's not. So, most importantly, we moved on pretty quickly from that. I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a one-time thing. We moved on to Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing Transformed and played it for about 3 hours.
Yep.
And we had a really good time with it. And my hope here, this is what I wanted to do with Call of Duty, but I kind of wanted to play co-op. And that's more or less what we did. Mm-hmm. So we went into the career mode of Sonic Racing. And, you know, you were playing on the gamepad, I think.
Yes.
I was playing on my pro controller. You know, we're doing the career stuff. You do the same events that you would in single player. It's just you have someone else also in the race. So it's not explicitly cooperative because we're still competing against each other and we're still trying to fight, see who can get first place. But Mike made a really good point in that he's replacing one of the AI characters.
Yeah.
So if either of us wins the race, the profile gets credit for beating that event and you maybe unlock something. Right. So you have twice as much chance. And
it's more so for some of these other less intuitive events where you're like racing against this one character and trying to stay ahead of him for 60 seconds or this, you know, the drift thing is you have to like stay in the middle where there's like a line where you have to drift on it. So it's like basically you have two chances to get it, you know, instead of just one.
And, you know, some of them could be a little bit more difficult with two people because you do bump into each other and you could get in the way. But in general, you know, you're probably not going to use weapons against the other player if you can help it. Yeah. And we found it really fun, very easy to help each other in various ways. It depends on the kind of event, like you said, but in general, it wasn't that hard to cooperate. And, you know, the other thing about that game is that anytime you do anything, the character that you chose to race with gains experience. Mm-hmm. So it also meant, because we're playing as two different characters on the same file,
right,
that we're leveling up characters twice as fast because we're both leveling up characters. And so we could constantly switch characters, and we just really had a great time with it. I mean, like I said, we played for like 3 or 4 hours, and it was funny because Mike knows Sega franchise a little bit better than I do, probably. So we were fiddling with the sound options to make sure the music was loud enough, because he wanted to hear the music and figure out what game all this stuff was from. That's a damn good game. Yeah. That's a $40 game too. I mean, it's a budget game, but it doesn't feel like it. It actually feels like a better value than probably a lot of other Wii U games really are, even at $60. And we didn't try going online, but we could have. I mean, mm-hmm. We kind of focused on the career mode mainly because there's so much variety even within that mode. But you can play virtually anything in the entire game with up to 5 players, including going online and playing against other groups of people. Because I think the races hold 10 characters, so you could actually do a group of 5 in one location versus a group of 5 in another.
That's crazy.
Which kind of harkens back to like Double Dash, you know, with the whole LAN party feature that no one ever really was able to use. But the game just works really well. It's super fun, and Mike was saying I think Neil has said this too, that Nintendo really should get this developer Sumo Digital to make the next Mario Kart. Because I think clearly they have the chops, they have the competency to do it, but also there's just so much more creativity and enthusiasm put into this game than there has been in the past few Mario Karts. I would love to see them kind of liven that series back up again with the same level of care that they've done with this one.
And if not Mario Kart, they might be more willing with F-Zero because they've already partnered once with the next team. And I mean, this game is pretty fast. And I could certainly see the team behind this doing F-Zero really well, too.
Yeah, good point. Either way, I would love to see these guys work with Nintendo again. And I think if you haven't yet played it, there's a demo. I don't know if the demo is any good, but this is maybe my favorite Wii U game right now. It's, just the one that I've come back to over and over. I've played it in a lot of different ways with different people, and it's maybe the most surprising game because I didn't necessarily expect that much out of it. And it really does live up to the hype that, people recommending it. It really does pull that off. Very cool. And then, we played the obligatory hour of Smash Brothers.
Yes, we did.
Which is anytime Mike comes over or I go to his house, we have to play Smash Brothers. It's a ritual. And we had a blast with it, of course. It was a little bit different experience for you.
It was a little different because you transferred your save file from Wii to Wii U. I no longer could use the WaveBird, and I'd been using the WaveBird for over a decade, right?
Right.
So it was a different experience, but I adjusted to it pretty well. And I used the standard classic controller, which is, I own that at home. I haven't really used it that much, but, aside from a few, like pushing left versus pushing down type things, it worked really well. So, it allayed my concerns over the next Smash Brothers and my ability to play it, because I think I adjusted pretty well.
On the new one, you'll also be able to use the Wii U Pro Controller, or you could use the gamepad. So you have a lot more options even than you do in Brawl.
Sure.
Brawl is Brawl.
Yeah.
It's hilarious, and, we could play it forever. So, that was our big Wii U multiplayer evening.
Yeah.
And that was really the only gaming we did all weekend. I mean, I showed you Ni No Kuni and some other stupid crap, but...
Well, we both played Ikachan.
That's right.
I hadn't heard what Yeoman said about the game, and Johnny's like, oh yeah, it's really fun, you should get it. So I bought it for $5.
Well, you got it because I said the words cave story.
Yeah, right. Right. And so I played it, and then I reached the end after an hour and a half. I'm like, wait, this is the end? Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I listened to Guillaume's discussion about it on the podcast just a couple days ago.
Well, I hope you listen to it.
Well, yeah, I always listen to the podcast after we publish it. So I always hear everything twice. And between when we recorded and when I listened to the final show, I'd play the game.
Right.
And I was a little dubious when Guillaume was first talking about it, just because I thought, well, it's probably not really that short, or it probably feels like more of a value than Guillaume is saying. And then when I listened to it the second time, I was like nodding my head the entire time. I agree with every single nuanced thing that Guillaume said about this game.
I was maybe too nuanced.
It's a very good game, but just so damn short.
It's well made, and the movement is interesting, and the graphics and the music are nice, but dude, it's really short.
It's not $5. I'm sorry. That's
it's
overpriced.
It's arguable. I mean, for some people, maybe will think that that's fine, but it's really stretching. You know, when you do have something like Gunman Clive, like we talked about last week, where it's at least as long as that game, and I would say as much fun, if not more so, and it costs $2.
Right.
And Gunman Clive is an unusually good value. I think Ichon is kind of an unusually bad value, but it's still a great game.
Yeah.
It's just, there's not much to it.
You can't overstate how there is no secrets to the game. What you do through the game, you do it once and you do it all, and there's nothing to go back to, and that's really disappointing.
Well, and when you have that kind of non-linear sort of Metroid-style map, you kind of assume that there are secrets, and you look for them, and yet you find places and you think they're secrets. It turns out it's just a required thing that you have to do.
Maybe they're really, really secret, and you just haven't found them yet.
I don't think so.
Nope. The game has been around for 12 years. I think people would have found it.
It's tempting to think that because there's some hardcore stuff hidden in Cave Story that's almost impossible to find. Yeah. But
and I was, you know, like I was looking at the inventory that you have in the game and you fill it up halfway. And I was like, well, surely I missed something. I must have missed something. Nope.
I mean, this very much feels like this was the trial run for his engine before he made Cave Story.
Yeah.
And it does playing it after Cave Story just feels weird.
It feels almost like a tech demo.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really well done.
Yeah.
But it's not really a full game. You know, it's really not. So it's too bad. I do like Ichon, but I kind of wonder if maybe one day there'll be some kind of sale, or you'll be able to buy it with Club Nintendo points or something, because that would make it a lot easier to recommend.
Yeah.
And then other than that, we basically skied and drove all weekend, and we ate a lot.
Yeah.
So that not too much gaming outside of that stuff. I did want to briefly mention, I finally beat Crimson Shroud, and it's a game. It took me a long time to get through it. My total play time is only like 8 hours, but apparently that's still much more than some people took to finish it.
Mine was also around 8 hours, but that's including at least 3 hours of being stuck in one place.
Yeah, and the part that you got stuck on, Guillaume, I just randomly got that item the first opportunity that you could. And so I got past that part. I was actually waiting to get stuck because I had heard so much about it, and I never did get stuck on that stuff because I was already past it, you know, before I realized it.
Lucky you.
Yeah, well, I got kind of stuck towards the end because the last two or three battles are so difficult, and I had to go around and sort of grind. Mm. And there aren't even really random battles. You just kind of – there's just certain places that have enemies that respawn, and you just have to go and farm them basically and get more items. And
you just have to act surprised every time that you run into them in the same spot.
Ultimately, I understand why some people like it, but – I have a lot of issues with Crimson Shroud, and mainly it's just that the battles are so slowly paced. They take for fucking ever to get through a battle because there's so much text scrolling by, and the enemies have a lot of hit points, and you know, you're rolling the dice, which is a cool mechanic, but it totally slows down everything. And you're constantly comparing all these stats. And the other part of it is the actual strategy of what I did in battles. It felt like it didn't really change that much over the course of the game. Like I would learn new skills and I would gain new items, but I didn't really feel like the encounters had that much variety to them. And, you know, you combine that with the sort of glacial pace of it all. That's why it took me 3 months to play through the game, because I just never was all that excited to play more of it. You know, I'd play like a little bit of it just to kind of say that I did, and I just get tired of it really quickly. You know, I beat the game. I could do New Game Plus. I kind of doubt that I ever will, even though I was starting to understand certain subtleties about the battle system and the item melding, which is not explained very well at all in the game. I finally figured out certain aspects of how that can benefit you towards the end. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a valiant effort. And, you know, if you had bought this package of mini games in Japan, this Guild Zero One, and this was one of them, it's easy to see why this one would stand out for its production value and its length and the kind of game that it is. It's maybe not something you'd be expecting in a package like that, but I don't know. I'm not that crazy about Crimson Shroud, but it's different. You know, it's interesting in its own way for sure.
I thought the encounters were, like, the battles were meaningful. Like, I mean, every time I felt like I had to actually fight through them, you know, like, not in a bad way. Like, I mean, I felt like every time there was a chance that they would wipe out my party. So, I don't know, it made it more fun than currently I'm playing Dragon Quest and, you know, it doesn't compare.
That's true. The battles are challenging, but I think that effect of feeling like each one is a unique obstacle in your way disappears when you end up having to fight the same one 5 or 6 times just so you can try to get a better item. So it doesn't totally work out, but I respect what you're saying about it. So that's all I've got. And Mike, did you have anything you wanted to bring up?
Not really. I mean, I've played a whole bunch of games over the last 2 months, which is rarity, but you've talked about most of them. I mean,
okay.
If Batman's good on Wii U, I mean, whatever, you know.
Does the gamepad stuff worked out okay for you?
It worked out okay. You know, I found that, I mean, I played the original Batman Arkham Asylum on my PS3, and I was always fumbling around with the controls on that because there's just so many different things that you can do, and there are modifiers. So I had similar problems fumbling in Wii U, but I wouldn't say it was any worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different kind of fumbling.
Did the motion control for stuff, did you use that? Is it optional?
Yeah, it's kind of optional. I wound up not really using it that much. I didn't really like using it for the Batarang or anything. So I played it pretty much the same way you would have played it on PS3, but it's still a great game. If you never played it, check it out on one of the systems. It's a fantastic game, and it put, you know, I went from that to Assassin's Creed 3 on my PS3, and I just can't get into that game. I just feel like it's just not nearly as compelling as Batman one, even though a lot of the mechanics are similar.
Yeah. Yeah, Assassin's Creed, I had to delete it temporarily because my Wii U storage filled up and I wanted to download other stuff. But once I get a hard drive set up, I'll be getting back into that. But Batman, Arkham City is a fantastic game. I'm just, especially if you didn't really find that the gamepad or the Wii U experience really benefited it too much, I would say you can get pretty much the same version of that game for about a fourth of the price on Steam or Xbox or PS3.
Right, agreed. I got this as a present, so.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what's exclusive to the Wii U, if anything, really. I know it comes with the Catwoman stuff. I don't know if that's exclusive to Wii U or if that's just DLC that was added later.
It was actually free DLC if you bought the game new on the other systems. I think they might have added a couple extra missions for her, but there's so much content already.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I don't know that you really need even more stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't think that really justifies a $60 price point for a game that's well over a year old, even when it came out on Wii U.
I've seen it for $50 in a lot of places.
Well, that's good. But I've seen the Game of the Year edition on Xbox for $15 recently. I'm going to say go get that one if you have a system to play it on.
Yeah. Fair enough.
All right, so that's all for us, and Guillaume is going to wrap up new business.
Yeah, well, very quickly, I've decided to basically only buy stuff on the eShop and to buy them using points cards because I thought it would help curb my impulse purchase tendencies.
Yeah, by putting all the games released in front of you in your home at all times, that's going to really curb your impulsive buying.
And the thing is, like, I wanted to get cards from Best Buy to get the reward points. But the thing is, though, I don't have an easily accessible Best Buy store, and for some reason, BestBuy.ca doesn't sell eShop cards, so I can't buy them online. So before the winter came, there is one Best Buy that I can access by bike. I don't have a car, so I had to bike there. And I just stocked up on eShop cards. And then I stupidly used them on my Wii U. If I knew then what I know now, I might have distributed them differently between my 3DS and my Wii U. But yeah, so I have an overabundance of points on the eShop right now, so even though I played the demo during E3 2011, I think, for Puddle, and didn't like it, and then downloaded the demo when it came out on PSN, and didn't like it, I still wanted desperately to buy something on my Wii U, so I got Puddle.
Oh, man, no. That stuff doesn't go stale. Just keep it on there. You'll use it eventually.
It's just, it made it easier to make the decision. And the fact that the game is only, like, $8, I don't know. I thought, like, you know, like, this looks so much like Fluidity. I love Fluidity. So maybe I should give it a third chance. And I'm, yeah, and I'm glad I did, to be honest. Initially, though, like, the game, it's a physics-based kind of platforming game where, just like in Fluidity, you tilt the level using the L or R buttons on the gamepad, or you can also use motion, but I haven't tried that. I just use the shoulder buttons. But you tilt the level to move your puddle of water around, or various fluids anyway. And so that's basically where the similarities with Fluidity end, because the game is much more physics-based, I suppose, and yet it really feels like many parts of each level is scripted. I'm not sure how to explain this, but the you know, for a game called Puddle, the your various fluids definitely resist getting into a puddle. They mostly kind of, whenever there's like a large surface, it's going to try to spread across it the most it can. And if you try to tilt a level so that, you know, to pool your water in a certain spot, it's going to resist it. And you can see kind of your water inch its way upwards in some cases, you know, defying gravity.
It's called surface tension, capillary action.
Like, it really feels at some, in some specific parts of each level, like the developers really want you to play a certain way. They want you to, you know, tilt left instead of right. And if you're not doing it, you're penalized for it. So I can't say that I'm very impressed with the physics of it all and the gameplay and the, you know, it really feels like it defeats the purpose of a physics-based game when randomly not your avatar.
Your liquid tar.
But anyway, like the fluids will just defy gravity for the heck of it.
I also got the game. And my observation is that you're, regardless of what fluid you're playing as, it has an incredibly viscous quality to it. It moves, even if it's just water, it moves very, it's very resistant to moving. It feels like it's a very heavy fluid regardless, so it's going up because the weight of the fluid is actually pushing itself up the surface it's on. It just doesn't feel right, though.
No, it kind of feels like perhaps the game is 20 times slower than real time. I guess perhaps if that's the case, then it makes sense, and it also explains why the game is so incredibly slow. But yeah, like, it doesn't feel right. But eventually you kind of hit a point where you get used to it, or at least I did. And that came to around the same time that the level design, or at least the environments, got really creative. And then something kind of clicked for me. I really felt like I was enjoying the game a lot more when I stopped fighting the physics, when I started just enjoying the levels for the sake of it. Kind of like, I guess in a way, like, it appeals to me at this point, kind of like Flower does, you know, like as an experience instead of a game. Because the game is very, you know, it's by an independent studio. It won awards before it was picked up by Konami. And then, you know, the reviews weren't too good, but that kind of indie side of it really comes through when you look at your water eventually becomes fertilizer, and then through the level you make flowers grow, and at some points you're in a lab and you have to avoid burners, and it's very mechanical. And then you, for some reason, you reach the end, and the scientist who's been brewing you just decides to gulp you down. And all of a sudden the levels are X-rays, living X-rays, where...
That's really cool.
You get warnings for when there's going to be hazards, pretty soon, like coming up, and, but these warning signs are basically like post-its with, like, you know, like a doctor's like scribble or something like that. The art in the game is just fantastic, and the game as a whole really looks fantastic. eventually you make your way through the digestive tract of that scientist. You get into his veins, and all of a sudden you have like the control scheme completely changes, and you have to keep shifting between left and right to make his blood pump to basically get carried through his bloodstream until you're eventually peed out by an apparently sexless scientist, and you make your way through to the sewers where you fall on some rat, which you melt, and then from then on you control like rat goop.
Huh? Wait, so you're saying urine melts rats?
Well, that specific urine.
Mine does.
I've tried. Mine does not.
Whatever that guy drank was pretty potent. And you know, like, right now I just finished a section where the game kind of played like Night Sky, of all games. You control a kind of a snow globe through the sewers. And, I don't know, like, the game really doesn't dwell too much on, you know, on certain mechanics or certain style or certain environment. So you get to see a lot of cool stuff, playing through it. It's very enjoyable. On the platforming side, like, you can get rewards for doing well. Like, if you keep if you finish with as much of the fluid as you can and as fast as you can get a gold, rating or something like that. But I don't find that side of the game very satisfying because you have to fight the physics so much. But as an experience, it's pretty cool. It's probably worth $8.
Can you play the whole thing on the gamepad?
Oh, yeah, you can.
Yeah.
I've done that.
Just by tilting it while you look at it?
Well, you can tilt it, or, you know, I've been playing with the shoulder buttons the whole time. And that works very, very well.
Very nice.
I've also been playing Rhythm Thief. I've been basically clearing off, like, all the games I started a month or two ago. I finished Paper Mario. And Rhythm Thief, for some reason, my file says that I've been playing it for 8 hours. Kind of feels like I've been playing it for 32. That game has not, like, I was, as we discussed on the best of 2012 episode, the game has fantastic presentation value, but I'm not enjoying the actual game side of it as much, or at least not for every level. The rhythm games are very varied, and they change up, and they have you do different things all the time. Like, sometimes you'll just be pressing the A button and that's all you're going to do. But other times you have to use motion. Other times you have to use a D-pad, and like the game really asks you to do different things, but they never really prepare you for them. So that's one thing that I think that Rhythm Heaven Fever does really, really much more intelligently, which is to give you basically a tutorial and to walk you through it and to make you do it before each and every minigame. Rhythm Thief just plunges you into a game and just expects you to know what to do, and it's not always that obvious. And even for minigames that seem to be very straightforward, like there's one where you just punch bad guys as they appear, I'm having a really, really hard time with it because the amount of time that you have to let elapse between when they show up and when you're supposed to punch them is not really clear to me. I never feel like I have a really, really good grasp of the whole timing of the game. And that's kind of a big deal in a rhythm game. I don't always feel like the rhythm of the gameplay matches the music. The game makes me feel not as if I have no rhythm, but as if the people who made this game have no rhythm.
I didn't have that impression with it. I could play the game almost with my eyes closed a lot of times.
I tried doing that, and it worked for me in Rhythm Heaven, but it doesn't work for me in this game. It's just, and I'm, you know, like, obviously some of the mini games you have to look at them because they're very, very visual. Like, you wouldn't know what to press if you're not looking at the colors or whatever. But I'm talking about a game where you literally only had to press A. It didn't click for me. And it was so frustrating. And it was around the 29th level of the game, I think, out of 40. Which happens to be kind of far into the game. It's, pretty much towards the end. And at that point, I had gotten A rankings on every mini game, and that's the point where I stopped caring. I was just like, okay, I just want to get it over with. I just want to enjoy the story and then move on. But yeah, the presentation values are fantastic from the beginning to the end, although I can't say that the story really is really that good. You know, the animation is fantastic, but the whole story is just a mishmash of anime tropes. It's kind of, you've got a little bit of Castle in the Sky in there, and you've got girl tomboy who's like the girl of a detective and who's a detective in her spare time. It's just like, I've seen that trope in Persona 4.
Is this so much different than a typical Layton game though? Like it looks really great, but, and maybe even the writing from moment to moment is pretty good, but the overall story is just kind of thrown together in nonsense.
Yeah, but just take, I don't know, to me it felt like, yes, a kind of a copycat of Layton, but slightly less enjoyable. In pretty much, you know, every aspect, like it's slightly below the average quality of a Layton game. For instance, when you're just, you know, touching everywhere on the screen to find coins, in Layton, I can forgive it because the coins you don't really need, and they're kind of usually placed in spots that make sense. Like you're going to see a lone window and you tap it and there's a coin hidden there. It kind of, you know, like it kind of makes sense. But in this game, you'll have like random notes in the sky, you know, in a clear blue sky. Like you're just supposed to tap each and every millimeter of the screen.
Well, you don't need all the coins.
No, but like, no, you don't need the coins, but you do need, if you want to unlock stuff, the, like partitions and like you've got other stuff that's hidden there.
Usually what it is once you find a note, you can find the whole chain.
I thought I was really being thorough and I still managed to miss one.
Yeah, I wasn't too worried about the notes. I mean, for me, what this game does is it takes about the same amount of care with respect to building a consistent narrative as the Layton games do. It's just the characters aren't as likable. I mean, to me, that's the biggest difference, is the characters are kind of... The main character's all well and good. I mean, he's kind of goofy. The female lead is a little bit of a flat character. I mean, she has a somewhat interesting backstory, but she herself is somewhat dull. The villain is Napoleon resurrected through no mechanism ever explained by anything ever.
Speaking of Napoleon, there are some really good lines in the game, and towards the, maybe it's a spoiler, but towards the end, at some point, like you're facing Napoleon, you have like several times during the course of the game, but now this is like the final showdown, and your character just shouts like, "Hey, Napoleon, Waterloo," and just goes to town, like as if it made any sense.
Beautiful and ridiculous at the same time. I absolutely approve.
Or one of the other lines that I really like is some random minigame where you help a chef cook food, and he's just like, "The food, it sings!" It's just the funniest delivery I've ever heard, and I can't do it justice, but yeah, there are some good moments in the game, but towards the end, I was just saturated. I just wanted to be done with it.
I think the game, the reason it doesn't have the staying power of the Layton games it semi-emulates, is that the pace at which you are doing things that are essentially the rhythm puzzles, is really more the rhythm events, it is relatively high. So you're basically going scene to scene, clip to clip, going through these, and there's not a ton of variety in them. Now, where games like WarioWare and Rhythm Heaven get off is there's no direct story conceit connecting the two. So all they do is throw you random stuff the whole time. It there's much more emphasis put on developing a variety of things to do, and they're built in such a way as to manage the fact that you're gonna have boom 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 boom.
You think Rhythm Thief maybe leans a little bit too heavily on the fact that it does have a story and these characters that it wants to tell? And maybe they put too much effort into that versus like varying up the kinds of gameplay.
One way or the other, I think either they didn't spend enough time on the gameplay, or they let the lack of gameplay get in the way of the storytelling sometimes. It's like they needed to decide one way or another how they want to do it, because there are adventure game components to this game, but they're very, very primitive. They're not particularly well developed. I mean, it's basically just go from point A to point B, and you can sort of explore Paris at your leisure, but primarily all you're doing is traveling from A to B, and it even shows you on the map what B is.
And by the way, this was one of your top five games of the year, James, whereas the new Layton for 3DS was not.
You know why? There's a good reason, though. I said at the time, I felt like this game did things differently, and it was more exciting to play at the time. I recognize it has some very important flaws, but I felt like it did things that I was happy with that, you know, Layton is probably still a more sound title, but the question of the reward of experiencing this, which felt newer versus experiencing another Layton.
Sure.
Which didn't.
It's totally valid to be in love with a flawed game.
Yes.
Yeah, and I can definitely, like, I'm of the same, like, I was kind of tired of the Layton games after the third one, like the time travel one.
That one's mental. How can you be tired after that one? That one is the most mental.
I took a break from that series, and I'm glad that Rhythm Thief is doing something different. And I am still glad that I got to play it. I just got fed up with it. But again, perhaps, I don't know if, you know, listeners know me well enough at this point, but I do get tired of games pretty quickly. don't let Persona 3, like my 70 hours into that game, fool you. Like, I will get tired of games really quickly, usually. Most people probably wouldn't have trouble with the game. I'm not sure. I don't think that I actually played only 8 hours of it. There's something weird with the way that the game calculates your time, because...
Check your 3DS system time. That'll give you more accurate representation.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the truth.
So one thing I will say about this game, and speaking to the fact that I put it on my top five list, is that if it weren't for the fact that Sega's going to go bankrupt sometime in the next year and a half, or somewhere in that time frame, I really think if they made a sequel to this game, they would probably iron out all the flaws that this one has.
I just don't know how they would ever justify that, given the sales, which are entirely self-inflicted.
Yeah, it's a shame, because I feel like a sequel to this game could be really, really good.
Well, maybe when they go third-party... Oh, shit, wait.
Maybe when all their assets are sold at auction.
Can they go fourth party?
Didn't Sammy already buy them?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't make a difference. They're still hemorrhaging money everywhere.
Not even the pachinko money can save Sega at this point.
We're going down and we're taking pachinko with us.
All right, well, speaking of checking the clock, we have run in a very large new business segment here among the five of us. We're going to take a much-needed break and come back with some listener mail, so stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First this week, we have a blog, The Rare Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon Crystal by Justin Berube. Another week, another increasingly disconcerting look into the life of Justin Berube. This week, he shows off the rare crystal sword given out by GameStop when this game was first released.
All right, and we have an interview. Speaking of disconcerting life of Neil Ronahan, an interview with Skylander swaps Chris Wilson by Neil and Jared. Ready your bank account for more plastic toys. Learn all about Activision's next plan to lighten your wallet and clutter your coffee table.
We have an interview, Castlevania Lords of Shadow, Mirror of Fate's producer. Wait, where does the title stop?
Okay. It's a huge title!
So the producer of this game, David Cox, and interviewed by Aaron. We have a lengthy video interview with Mirror of Fate's producer to get insight into the castle and the Vania.
Yes.
And the shadow and the lords and the mirror.
Yes.
And the thunder.
You can't get insights into a mirror because it just looks back at you. Mm.
Alright, next up we have a feature called Japan eShop Roundup. Oh, we have this one every week.
This week we're featuring it.
That's right. By Danny Bivens. Don't believe the Japanese eShop gets the better deal? This week, downloadable versions of Layton Miracle Mask, that's actually a special edition of it,
yep.
Dragon Quest VII, motherfuckers, Double Dragon, and Crystal Warriors.
Wait, Dragon Quest VII is on a Nintendo platform?
It's just remade on 3DS. Just came out, and they released a digital version.
And the first NES Double Dragon, which we never got on the Wii Virtual Console for some unfathomable reason.
Yes, it is. Konami. Yeah. And Crystal Warriors is a Game Gear game that's actually good. Making it the only Game Gear game that's actually good.
All right, we also have a blog, Brain Age Concentration Training by Tyler Olu. Tyler is giving us daily updates on his progress training his brain. Can Dr. Kawashima save his 70-year-old brain? Find out!
I think he's in pretty good shape. He does daily puns as well.
Yeah, that proves that you can concentrate. Mm-hmm. Alright, so be sure to go check out all of this great original content, plus much more and the latest news over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back. It's time for listener mail. And the address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. The first email today is going to be read by James, and it's very hot off the presses.
So, first email is from Ishan. He writes, "This morning Ubisoft announced that Rayman Legends is going multi-platform. And with that, Wii U's Western third-party support is non-existent. And so far, not many third parties in Japan have pledged support either. So, the question is, what can Nintendo do to help turn the ship around? Dragon Quest and Monster Hunter exclusivity for 3DS are great in Japan, and Nintendo's portable strategy seems to have locked down the two portable franchises, aside from their own, that really matter. It's an effective strategy. In console space, that's harder to do, because console games are far more expensive to develop, and the financial incentive you'd have to offer a third-party publisher for exclusivity is much greater. Nintendo could negotiate for an exclusive Final Fantasy game, but unless it's Final Fantasy XV, it wouldn't be worth the effort and money involved, and that's never going to happen, because I'm sure Sony is going after Square Enix exclusives as we speak. Bayonetta and The Wonderful 101 are great exclusives to have, and I'm sure Monolith's new game will be too. But none of those will help move Wii U consoles and help bring significant genre leader to the Wii U that causes other third-party games in the genre to follow suit. So in your opinion, what are their options?"
Well,
I gotta say,
we've had this problem for a long time. It's maybe more acute here earlier in the life cycle. I'll say what I've always said. Nintendo needs to really champion third-party games. I mean, they always tend to talk a lot about their own. They need to go out there and push third-party stuff, even at the expense of their own. Because their own games are going to sell regardless.
They do sometimes, but they push the wrong ones. I mean, they spend 10 minutes at E3 talking about an old version of Batman. You know, I mean, they kind of put out these olive branches and they try to promote stuff, but then it's never the games that people really care about the most.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Or care about anymore.
Yeah. They seem really behind the times when they do. So,
We just talked about Black Ops 2. I mean, Nintendo barely said a darn thing about that game, but it's one of the biggest releases of the year across any platform. But it's just really a non-factor for them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they thought they would get drowned out by all the other attention that game's going to get for different platforms. But I think their version is distinct enough that, you know, they really could have kind of sold it and have, you know, showcased it as being something special. And I don't really think they did that. This stuff about Rayman, it
sucks.
Really, I mean, look, I mean, in terms of the game itself, it's still going to come out.
Yeah.
And I've said this for years, and I'll always say this, that I don't have a problem with games going multi-platform, because I think the more people who can play them, the better.
Yeah.
You know, especially if it's a really good game that I like. But in this case, you've got a Wii U version is done. It's ready to come out in February, and the developers, this is all breaking news, but the developers are like out on message boards saying, "We've busted our asses in crunch mode for the last 4 months to get this game finished for Wii U, and it's done, and now it's going to sit there on Ubisoft warehouse shelves for 6 months while we go off and bust our asses again to make Xbox and PlayStation versions." So those guys are super pissed, and as Nintendo fans, we have a right to be pissed, not because other people are going to get to play our game, but because this game is done and it's being delayed on Wii U for no good reason. That yep. sucks.
Yeah, that does
it's
suck.
It's being delayed because Ubisoft only wants to have to pay to market it once, basically.
Yep.
And that's just really shitty.
Yeah, but like right now their marketing would be basically, you know, they would have all the space for themselves. Whereas in September, like, it's going to be crowded as hell. Past E3, we're going to know of so many games coming out later in the year, and Rayman just will have that much harder of a time to stand out.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo has demonstrated that you can advertise games hard that have already been out for a long time. They've done it, you know, with games like, you know, New Super Mario Brothers and Mario Kart, where holiday time comes around, and they just push advertisements for old games, and they sell well. In some cases, they caused the game to sell after it hadn't originally. I think that was the case for, like, I don't know, Brain Age or something?
Well, yeah, I don't know. But this is a little bit different problem because what Ubisoft was facing, this is caused by a couple different things. They're looking at sales of third-party stuff on Wii U, and they're saying, if we actually release this as a Wii U exclusive, we're not going to make our money back on it.
Right.
It's going to be a disaster. We have to go multi-platform with it, but the other versions probably haven't even been started yet before this announcement was made. And if we release it now on Wii U and then release inferior versions on these other systems 6 months later, it's not going to sell on those other systems because all the press and all the, you know, all the word of mouth will be for the Wii U version, which is probably going to be still be the best version. And then these other versions are going to come out much later when there is more competition from GTA 5 and, you know, whatever else is coming out in September, October timeframe. And those other versions aren't going to sell. So why did we even do them in the first place? So they're saying we have to release all these versions at the same time in order to give this game the attention that it deserves. But the reason that, I mean, and that's justifiable. You know, I can't argue with that. I think that's a real issue that they have. But the reason that they're having to go multi-platform with it is because a Wii U exclusive third-party game right now makes no financial sense whatsoever. And that's Nintendo's fault. That's not Ubisoft's fault.
Yeah, but at the same time, remember what happened to Origins, Rayman Origins, which came out towards the, you know, around the holiday season. And no one bought the game at full price on day one. I remember I was the only one I knew who bought it, and that's because the Wii version was at $30 on Amazon.ca the first day. It was already on discount, you know, on day one. And on every other platform for at every other retailer, it became on discount barely a month after it got released. And people were still ignoring it until after the holidays, when people had actually played the games that they were actually looking forward to. I mean,
it
the
was
game
too crowded.
Yeah, and Origins came out at the same day as Assassin's Creed Brotherhood. And Ubisoft
way to shoot yourself in both feet. Ubisoft.
Well, seriously, like Ubisoft waited until like 8 at night to even tweet about Rayman. The whole day, the at Ubisoft account was just tweeting about Assassin's Creed and, oh, make sure you pick it up and, you know, like this review, that review. And Rayman got no attention at all from Ubisoft.
I mean, that might be indicative of their priorities. I don't think the Twitter activity had any difference one way or the other, but...
No, I know. But like, not only did it get no attention from gamers, but it got no attention from Ubisoft themselves. And now
you're right.
They're going to repeat this.
You're right. And one of the exciting things about Rayman Legends is that it seemed Ubisoft was kind of getting behind it a little bit more. They were really pushing it. It was a big presence at E3. They put out a demo well in advance of the game coming out, and it's been getting, you know, really, really good critical press in advance. And it seemed like, especially because it was coming out in February in this kind of dead zone where, especially on Wii U, nothing else coming out, but really even for all the other platforms, there's nothing of note coming out. The new systems haven't even been announced yet. This is almost the perfect time to release a game like this to really give it a fighting chance. And it's not happening anymore.
You say that Ubisoft was behind it. What about Nintendo? Like, it was the only playable demo at their Wii U kiosks. All over, like, at retailers.
In the stores.
It still is.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
I'm kind of, like, at this point, I'm kind of wondering where Reggie is, because we didn't see him for the, you know,
well,
the last Nintendo
Direct. Well,
hopefully
he's rampaging through their Montreal offices.
I suspect that Ubisoft said, hey, give us some more money to release it, continue to release it exclusively, or we're going to delay this and go multi-platform. And they said, we don't want to take your blackmail and said, walked away.
Ridge's Haitian, right? I mean, he can't speak French any worse than he does Japanese, so maybe he is up there in Quebec just going nuts on people.
And by the way, if we have any listeners out there who are really good artists, please.
Yeah. We should
please,
have a contest.
Please and make.
Man, I mean, this is shitty for Wii U fans. I mean, there's probably a fantastic game finished on Wii U, which is a system that desperately needs new great games that everybody is excited about. Mm-hmm. It's done, and Ubisoft's just going to, like, hold on to it until these other versions are out.
I cannot fathom how – I mean, as a software developer, I cannot fathom how incredibly frustrating this experience
is. Yeah, especially when it's just some dude in a suit making the call that has nothing to do with, like, the time and effort you put into making the game, you know? Very frustrating.
I mean, it's known outside of development circles that crunch time is really hard and you work really hard to get things on target. And this game had already been pushed back once, which meant crunch time was probably longer than anybody had ever planned.
Right. Yep.
And it's such a physically and emotionally demanding process that the release is really the payoff.
It's really the release in more ways than one.
It is literally a physical release, and also it's like you've been released from confinement.
Yeah. From prison.
And when you have a game that you know is really good, that you're really looking forward to, or in my case, when I have a piece of functionality I've created that I know is really impressive, and I know that it's going to make people's lives really easier, the release is something you look forward to so much because the emotional reward you get is the praise that comes to your work. People say, yeah, this was really cool. I'm so glad this is there, because then you could say, okay, it was all worth it. But if it's just going to go on a shelf for months, I don't think I could do it.
It's got to be really demoralizing, and I bet they're going to lose a lot of talented people over this. If their management's saying, we don't really care that you're doing good work here, I know I would be looking for another job or something like that.
This game's being developed in Paris, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So at Michel Ancel Studios. So I don't know.
I don't think it's in one place. I'm sure there are developers on this game.
I'm sure.
From all over the world.
Yeah, that's how Ubisoft works. Yeah. But I think primarily it was in Paris. And I wonder if the guys working there really have a lot of other job opportunities in that area, because Paris is not exactly a hotbed of video game development in terms of a lot of different.
No, but I mean, it's not like they couldn't go somewhere else in the EU. There's.
Sure.
I guarantee you almost everybody in that studio speaks English.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous move by Ubisoft. It is the most Ubisoftian of moves. I mean, I
can understand why they did it. Yeah. It's super shitty, but I think that, you know, if you try to look at it from a cold financial perspective, I can understand it. Again, I mean, I think ultimately the blame is on Nintendo. I certainly think Ubisoft could handle this better. And in terms of what Ubisoft could do to make this a better situation, I would propose, how about this? Like, maybe release the Wii U version only on the eShop and give it no marketing. So the people who already know about it and already excited and have already downloaded the demo themselves and know how to get to it on that eShop, they can go ahead and play it now, and they can bring in a little bit of money on it. And then for the retail version, wait until the other ones, and it can pick up some momentum from all the marketing they're going to put behind it when those come out. So you almost get to sell it twice to the same platform.
Yeah, but the thing is, they want – the reviews are going to come out with the eShop version. They want the reviews to hit alongside their marketing campaign.
Yeah, there is that, but the reviews are also going to come out again when the other versions are released.
Are they? I mean, are sites really
going to – At least they will.
They will, yeah.
Yeah, I
guess. Xbox is not going to review the Wii U version.
Well, no, but I mean the larger media probably –
Does Team Xbox still exist?
I have no idea.
I think
I'm sure
they do.
It does.
Probably, right? So there's got to be a compromise here, right?
I mean, I understand why you slide blame on Nintendo for this, but I really can't. I mean, Nintendo has done more than their fair share to help promote this game.
That's true. Yeah.
They've featured it very heavily. They've put it on their freaking demo consoles. It was the first game the majority of people who played a Wii probably played. Because it was the only demo you could play for months at a store.
So I think we need to get back to the question, is there anything more Nintendo can do to salvage the situation?
To keep this from happening again.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Do something.
I mean, short
they should
short
probably
of paying
whatever they whatever they should do, they should have done already.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a problem that's hard to fix after launch. Like this is, you know, I mean, James, you say that Nintendo's been supporting this game really heavily already, but I would argue, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, because of development struggles, Ubisoft had to delay the game into February. It was going to be a launch game where it probably would have done great as a launch game. But because they had to push it to February, it gave Ubisoft enough time to gain perspective on just how healthy the third-party market was going to be and just how healthy the platform was going to be. And what they saw was not great, as we all know. And that is Nintendo's fault. And this process that Ubisoft is now going through very publicly, to the point where their developers are even going out there and like slandering the executives over how angry they are, This is being echoed in many other developers around the world, because the Wii U looks just as bad to them as it does to this Ubisoft team. Yeah. So that's what concerns me. It's not even just this one game. It's all the other games that you don't even know about that are getting delayed or canceled or moved over to different platforms. That's why we should be concerned.
That's the thing. There's also, you know, things you hear too, like what was it, EA – in their earnings call, they said that they don't think of the Wii U as a next-gen console. Like, they just flat out don't say – they just flat out said that they don't consider it a next-gen console.
Well, they're probably talking in terms of development resources, and I can understand that, you know, from that perspective. But what they should – and that's – it's not totally incorrect, especially from a company like EA's perspective, because of the way that they have to categorize the projects that they're working on. But what they should be looking at it for is the Wii U not as a next-gen system, whatever that even means, but as a new market. It's an untapped market. It's a platform that they can sell to that they couldn't sell to in the previous fiscal year. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that EA is doing a very good job with it either.
Yeah.
No, I mean, they've – unless something's changed from once I last heard, there's no Madden for this year.
Yeah.
That's bullshit. They're going to announce it way – I mean, a lot of people thought there wouldn't be a Call of Duty on a Nintendo platform until about October when Activision finally got around to showing the Wii U version.
Why would they not announce it when they announced all the others?
Because it's a different version. It doesn't look like those versions. It doesn't have the same feature set as those versions.
You're thinking we're going back to My Play or whatever they called the
Wii version? We're going to get three cartridges of players.
It could be that the Wii U version is going to be based more on the 360 and PS3 versions, which are still going to be the best-selling versions of Madden this year, even if it does appear on new consoles. But also, it could be that Nintendo is doing what they should with EA, and maybe they're helping them to develop a version that takes better use of the system's capabilities and is something more that they can really showcase, and they're going to announce that at a separate event.
You're an optimistic man, Johnny.
That is very optimistic. I agree. But either way, I think probably they don't gain very much from showing a Wii U version, which may not even exist yet, because it's probably going to be some conversion from another version.
Yeah, but I mean, it could just be a lot. I mean, it could have just been a line on a press release, though. I don't know what the net gain of waiting.
Yeah, the mystery behind
it. Didn't come out
weird.
And say that it's not coming to Wii U. They just didn't come out and say that it is coming to
there
Wii U.
There have been plenty of other games that this has happened.
That Nintendo fans have been stung by Nintendo not saying that Xenoblade was coming to the Wii. And we kind of all dread now when announcements are not being made. Because most of the time it means that it's not coming.
Anybody who's been playing games long enough but was tapped into the larger gaming industry probably before the internet's real birth and knew what games were coming out in Japan on the Super Nintendo and the NES and knew they weren't coming. I mean, this is something that you just sort of live with. It's like having grown up during the Depression. You just sort of know, all right, this game really hasn't been announced and it's been a while. Oh, God, we're probably never going to get it.
Look. EA released, what, 4 Madden games on the N64. I'm just not concerned. I know you can look to Dreamcast and say, well, they pulled sports support for Dreamcast and it killed that system. Yeah, but they did that because Sega was making their own NFL game and they didn't want to compete with them. It's a totally different situation. So I think the idea that EA is not going – I mean, EA probably still publishes Madden on PS2. I know they did a couple years ago. So the idea that they're not going to put it on Wii U is absurd to me. It may not be a good version. They may not give a shit about it, but That's an impossibility in my mind that there will not be a new version of Madden this year for Wii U.
Especially when you think that they could just easily pour it over the 360 engine to Wii U. Like what happened with Black Ops 2. I mean,
not to mention they've already got a version of it working on Wii U because there was that launch game. So it takes minimal effort to at least do a roster update. At least.
A launch game.
Yeah. Well, hey, some people like it. I don't know. Man, I mean, do you guys have any ideas? This is a really tough question.
So here's an option they had, and unfortunately it's passed them by. They could have been a player at the auction for those.
Yeah.
Those franchises THQ. That went up. Yeah. I mean, they had cash. Nintendo has a huge war chest.
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of those franchises really aren't their thing, though.
No, but something like Darksiders is not that hard to.
No, but
to,
I mean, they could have gone after
their catalog.
They could have gone after the studios too that went up.
Yeah,
I mean, they didn't necessarily have to worry about the.
They haven't done that,
but the talent.
That's the thing. They haven't done that for a long, long time, though. They haven't really pursued. I mean, they used to buy out smaller studios, but they just don't do that second party stuff anymore.
Well, I mean, they just reincorporated Brownie Brown. I mean,
yeah.
Bought Monolith not that long ago.
They bought Monolith about 10 years ago.
Really? Is that long ago?
Yeah, it was towards the end of the GameCube era.
It was around Bot and Kaitos.
It was the Zero, the one that came afterwards. Yeah. The sequel was the last game they developed before they got bought out. But, I mean, they certainly could have. I mean, even if it was just for one or two games, it's not third party, but it at least would give them some platform for showing the potential for successful Western games, or at least not successful, they would have someone who's contractually obligated to keep trying.
I don't think that's a winning strategy. I mean, they've tried it before, and it just doesn't seem to work. You know, Silicon Knights, things sort of fizzled out, and Retro Studios is a rare example where it seems to be going well for them, but, you know, Left Field Studios, and even Rare kind of.
Field made good games. I mean, the problem is more that even if that strategy doesn't work, at least it's something. At least there's some conduit of games being produced in a more Western style to the system.
Here's the problem, James. Whenever Nintendo makes a first-party game, it sells really well, and people say, well, third-party can't compete with first-party. But if Nintendo doesn't make first-party games, people say, well, Nintendo isn't establishing that this system is good. So it's like they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. And it makes it really difficult.
I know. I think that's a little bit of a false choice that people set up for Nintendo. I don't think you actually have to choose between those two.
No, but that's still what publishers say, though. No, like that's the excuse that they come up with. Yeah,
the industry's attitude is.
Publishers say that because they're making excuses for their own failures, and their own failures are maybe their fault, and maybe Nintendo's fault to some extent.
And they're also probably looking for a handout from Nintendo in order to advertise their product.
I think there is an element of Nintendo doesn't play ball.
Yeah.
You know, I think they don't do the whole what do they call it in radio?
Payola,
yeah.
Money hats.
Yeah.
There's some that's the modern term, money hats, but there's some of that. I mean, Nintendo does help with marketing dollars for certain companies and certain games, but again, a lot of times when they do that, I feel like they don't necessarily choose the best horse in the race.
They're propping up secondary tier things instead of pushing for the top tier
stuff. Going out and publishing something like Ninja Gaiden 3, it seems like they improved that game. I just don't know that that's really a net positive for them. I don't know that the world gives a shit that they saved Ninja Gaiden 3 from being a massive bruise on Tecmo's career. So I don't understand sometimes the way that they choose their priorities with third-party stuff.
You can go back to, like, it's similar thing with Bayonetta 2. Cool. It's great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's awesome. It's just a weird franchise that they have come down like a savior and just be like, we will save this franchise.
Yeah.
I think
they'd almost be better off for pushing a third-party game that's already planning to come out and saying, putting that money towards, no, buy our version of this game because it's really cool for these reasons.
Yeah, and
they don't do that.
When you've got stuff like, when you've got any of these multi-platform games, there's a number of them coming out. I mean, Sonic and Sega All-Star Racing is a good example. That game came out on 5-6 different platforms. I venture to say the Wii U version is probably easily the best because of this, the gamepad support and the stuff that you can do with it. It's also a great fit for the Nintendo audience. And Nintendo hasn't supported that game. They haven't gone out and promoted that game. And I think, you know, if you as the platform owner can't go out and explain to people and convince them that your version is the best, then maybe you should think about what your platform really does and what it's actually capable of. Because if it's not obvious to the consumer that your version can at least has the potential to be the best, then I would say maybe you've designed your system very poorly. You know, maybe the system itself is the problem. And I'm not slagging on Wii U because I think it does have a lot of good capabilities. But, you know, even Nintendo has said, we're not totally sure what to do with it yet. And I think you can see that in the games that they've shown so far. And third parties definitely don't know what to do with it yet. And even in the rare cases when a third party does find a really cool use for it, it seems like they don't really get any attention for it. You know, I mean, they don't. I don't know. I mean, we haven't even mentioned Zombie U, which is probably the best exemption to this whole discussion because it has sold pretty well and it has gotten a lot of positive attention, mostly good reviews. And
Ubisoft is doing this.
And Nintendo has promoted it to some extent, you know. So, I mean, I think that is a success story, but it's maybe the only success story. And that's just not enough to convince people that the system is viable for their game. So it's a bad situation. I do feel like Nintendo needs to do something drastic and pretty soon. And, you know, saying that there's a new Mario game coming out, I don't know that that's the recipe. I think there needs to be some kind of initiative with third parties, maybe some big announcement, maybe a couple of big announcements. I don't know. I think they need to kind of change the tone of the conversation here, not just our conversation, but the conversation that happens in those boardrooms, you know, with these third-party publishers, especially in the West. It does not look good right now.
Yeah,
really.
The thing is,
this is a bad, bad, bad situation with Rayman.
And how do you choose the right horse to back? Because like any established franchise that they could choose. Has been established on the PS3 or 360, basically.
The answer is you don't pick the one to win, Guillaume. You want to foster a community where the third parties feel like, yeah, we really should develop for this. Then you don't have to choose one and bet on it.
Yeah.
You have 10 that could potentially win, quote unquote, right?
They're coming to you.
Right, exactly.
It seems to work pretty well for Microsoft.
Yes.
But Microsoft has the most successful console right now. They're the number one selling console in America for the past, 24 months straight?
Wow.
That does a lot to get attention of third-party publishers.
It's almost kind of funny that Microsoft wants to jump console generations right now.
They have. Like, they just have to.
I know. But like for them, it seems like a bad economic proposition.
Their system is almost 8 years old.
I know.
They have no
but
choice.
It's still selling decently well.
And don't really they're not the ones that are the most in a hurry either. I mean, I think
Sony's the one in most in a hurry.
Yeah, Sony's like, I hope we can lose another $1 billion as soon as possible.
It was Nintendo, and Nintendo was the first. Yeah. But now Sony is the next.
Sony's going to actually go out desperate. In the middle of their courtyard and set $1 billion on fire.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, Sony's funny because, I mean, they release – I mean, the PS3 worldwide, I mean, it's pretty much neck and neck with 360 sales-wise. But
yeah.
They put the Vita out, and I mean – the Vita is just tanking, and they you know, it's like
show.
It's you know you're in a bad spot when you're Sony and you're looking for a console release to prop up your handheld release.
That is so.
That's
backwards.
Just bad.
Well, I guess if nothing else, we can say Wii U is doing better than Vita.
Yes.
Wii
that's
is
not
doing better
saying
than
much
Vita.
Right now.
I don't know, man. If I'm just. I don't know if I'm just being negative, but I feel like all three console makers are kind of fucked. I'm not sure, like, budgets for games seem to only be getting bigger and bigger, and, you know, publishers are going to be more and more conservative, and more teams are going to fold. You know, we're going to get fewer devs, or, like, they're only going to be working in tandem with other devs on super AAA franchises.
Well, Nintendo's in a better spot than the others in that perspective, because they were able to rely upon smaller scope games to make a lot of money, more so than a lot of these other first party and third party.
But I mean,
publishers.
The stuff you're saying, I mean, it's an increasingly popular opinion that the console industry is just in a bad place right now. It's been in a bad place for a long time in Japan, mm-hmm. and Nintendo's done actually a very admirable job of saving it, but not totally successful. And I think in the West, I don't know. I mean, consoles are still doing pretty well in the West up to now. It's more like, can we actually make this jump? You know, I don't know. It's going to be a really interesting year.
There's the theory for Nintendo to operate under. Do nothing. Release the Wii U and wait for the point that companies like Sega can't afford to develop even more expensive games without going bankrupt. Exclusive because this is the only platform we can afford to make.
Yeah.
But a lot of – what's funny is it's actually would have made more sense this generation than last generation.
Yeah.
Because this time, A, more companies are in a bad place. And B, I mean, the games that come out for the HD consoles now still look really, really good.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Ouya saves the industry. But we have to move on, and John is going to read the next email.
All right, Shad in Tennessee writes, I'm getting married in about 2 months. For the next year or so, the large majority of our money is going towards our new house and bills. So, Wind Waker aside, I'm going to be gaming on a budget. I recently downloaded Shantae, Gunman Clive, and Link's Awakening, thanks to hearing them discussed on the show, and have enjoyed them all very much, even playing Link's Awakening 4 times straight. I was hoping you guys could recommend some games to help me build an eShop wish list, especially Dr. Metz, whose opinions tend to reflect mine 85% of the time. That's obviously been clinically proven. And it doesn't have to be solely 3DS downloads. Despite favoring it for downloads, I also have a Wii U. P.S. If you guys don't care, I'd love to give a shout-out to my wife-to-be. I love you, Michelle.
Well, that's very sweet. So...
Well, it's hard to tell because we don't know what games he's already played.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
The Wario Land 2 is a very good pick for the 3DS Virtual Console. I've been playing that.
And yes.
I mean, I love that game. I haven't played it in a while, and it holds up really well.
Excellent value.
Yeah.
For sure. On the Wii U, I mean, in terms of the Wii U eShop, your selections are still fairly limited in terms of budget gaming. I mean, if you consider a $40 retail game to be budget, I would highly recommend Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing, but that's $40, so that, you know, may be outside the scope of this question. It's an excellent value.
It's got a lot of single-player content, and it's got online, and you're trying to maximize your gaming dollar, there's few things that you can do better than...
I think he already maximized his gaming dollar playing Link's Awakening 4 times.
I've done that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say on Wii U, probably your best bet is to go into the Wii Shop channel.
Yes.
Yeah.
And look at, there's some WiiWare stuff like La Mulana and Cave Story, very good values. There's, of course, on the Virtual Console, I mean, there's all these great RPGs, stuff like Final Fantasy 2 and 3 on Super Nintendo.
Link to the Past.
Ys 1 and 2. Yeah, all that stuff is.
Yeah.
I mean, these games, like, they seem obvious to us because we probably have the original versions too. And so when we paid $8 for Link to the Past, it's like, oh, cool, I'm going to get to play through this again. But if you've never played that game, that is a ridiculous deal. $8 to play Link to the Past. Like, there's a lot of stuff like that. You know, there's some fantastic old RPGs. And RPGs, especially on a Virtual Console where the pricing is standardized and it is fairly low to begin with. Those are really good values. Those are long games, and you can, you know, Ogre Battle 64 is a great choice too for the same reason.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a game of RPGs people probably missed if they played the Super Nintendo era. Breath of Fire.
Breath of Fire 2 especially. Yeah.
I would only play one, but if you're going to play them both, play one first cuz you will not be able to go back.
Chrono Trigger.
but 2 is really, it's one of my favorite RPGs ever.
Yeah.
There's the Etrian Odyssey 4 demo that just came out on the 3DS eShop.
Just play the demo over and over.
Well, you know, like, the game is going to be $40, but the previous games have been republished recently, and they're probably still available, you know, for purchase new. So if you want to look that up, the game is supposed to be like 100 hours long, and the people who love it seem to find it infinitely replayable. Like, they try new formations, and I don't know. It sounds pretty cool. I tried the demo today, and I'm really enjoying it. And I feel like it's something I could really get into.
Yeah. Another one you might want to check out if you haven't played it yet is VVVVVV.
Yes.
I mean, the main game isn't that long. It's still a really good game, but the 3DS game comes with like a bunch of fan-made or other expert game developer-made levels that are pretty long. There's like 20 of them.
Yeah.
And so if you really like that game and you can come back to it, you know, every once in a while and do one of these sort of bizarre world versions of VVVVVVV, and it could last a really long time too.
Yeah. Another good choice, it would be either Pushmo or Crashmo, sure. Which are both, I think they're around $8 or something on the eShop, and they have hundreds of levels, not to mention downloadable levels from Nintendo. You can go online and get QR codes for stuff that other people have made. So, I mean, you can, if you really love those games, you can wring tons of content out of them for very little money. That's another good choice. And the pinball games are good, too, if you like pinball. I mean, they're highly replayable. Highly.
Yeah, I was looking at my most played games on the 3DS, and pinball is up there. Maybe it's not something that you want to play exclusively. Sometimes you need to take a break from pinball. But, yeah, you can sink a lot of time just trying to go for your high scores. It's a great time killer.
Yeah, I'd say either one of the Fluidity games on either Wii or 3DS, they're both surprisingly long, like 15 hours long each, probably. So if you like the mechanics, and there's a demo, try it. If you like the mechanics in the demo, go for the full thing. But I think they're very good values.
I can't speak to the second one, but I did not like the first one. So
it's not.
But if you tend to like what Johnny likes, yeah, then go for it.
It's not everyone's cup of tea, but yeah. I'm a big fan for sure.
And going back to the Virtual Console, you know, there's actually, since you're getting married, there's actually some really good multiplayer games out there that, you know, maybe that's one way to increase the value you get out of your game.
How about Secret of Mana?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah, I'm trying to. But yeah, I mean, there's so many things available on those systems that there's plenty of stuff to get around to that reasonably affordable.
Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well, thanks for writing, Shad, and congratulations to you and Michelle. So we're going to wrap up here. And Guillaume, could you read the next email, please?
I can. Chris, a.k.a. PH Nintendo in Maryland, writes, I have enjoyed the Miiverse and even found some helpful hints and awesome artwork by Jeremy Parrish, among others. My wife even calls it my version of Twitter, since I am not normally a fan of social media. I have also noticed that some people started strong on the Miiverse and now do not really post. I was wondering what you guys think the reason is for this, and I would like to hear some of your ideas to improve the service and get people posting again. Some of my ideas include adding colors like Swapnote, add video to the screenshot feature, increase the friend limit, and obviously release more games that use the service. And my number one suggestion, let us form our own communities, like an NWR community.
The NWR community is the Funky Barn community.
It sounds like they're kind of doing that, though, with the upcoming release of the Wii Fit game. I forget the Wii Fit You, I guess.
Wii Fit You.
It sounds like they're creating this sort of a community concept, and it sounds like they may be doing that for other games.
Yeah, because they wanted it to be private so you could discuss your weight,
right,
basically with people who you've kind of controlled the list, so you don't have to throw it out there in public.
So your Miiverse is I am fat.
Well, I think the only option here is to get home release for Miiverse. You know, Sony can just port it over. So, nobody uses it on the Sony servers, so might as well just port it over.
They're still updating home too. It's unbelievable.
Welcome to Uncanny Valley.
My favorite home story ever is the news article about some parent reporting to local news that their child walked in on somebody else's home with video playing of an adult variety.
imagine that. How has no one ever made a game called The Uncanny Valley?
Welcome to Uncanny Valley.
It's probably on Xbox Indie Arcade, and it's probably awful.
I think Chris's ideas are really great. The adding video to the screenshot feature is probably not technically feasible because of the memory that it would require. But I would say making the screenshot feature a little more intuitive. I don't even know how to do it. And I own a Wii U, and I've used Miiverse.
It varies from game to game. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, some games can. That's a big problem.
Yeah, the games have to implement it.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, that's no way to handle that kind of thing.
Yeah, you got to have that stuff across everything, so.
Well, I can tell you that my usage of the Miiverse, fell through just because I wasn't really playing on the Wii U for a little while. So definitely releasing more games will help, that's for sure. But also, as I was playing through the cave, I found the Miiverse really helpful because I would scroll and look and see if other people were stuck at the same spots that I was. Unfortunately, there were tons and tons and tons, at least like 3 to 2 people were just like begging for yays. You know, they wanted you to give them yays for some reason. I don't know. Like these
give me
things,
all the yays.
Yeah, like they serve no purpose. But yeah. Some kids decided that they were really important and really wanted them, so they begged for them. It makes no sense. And recently, Nintendo updated the terms of service. They're asking people not to do that anymore. So I don't know if the mods are going to be enforcing that. I really hope so, because it really got in the way of using the Miiverse, the forums, for what they were intended for.
It's spam. Yeah. It's spamming the forums, and they don't want that.
Right. And they're limiting how often you can post, which I don't know if that's really a problem or not, but we'll see. I think, aside from rules of conduct in terms of service, one thing that they could do to make Miiverse much more useful and much easier to integrate into the way you play is to make it load up faster. And they're kind of already planning to do that. But I have a big problem with saying, when I turn on the Wii U and it takes just as long to check Miiverse as it does to turn on an actual game, I'd rather play a game, So if the Miiverse stuff isn't shown within the game like it is in Mario or I guess Zombie U, that's really good because then I can use Miiverse while I'm playing the game. But if I have to switch between the two and it takes 45 seconds both ways, I'm not going to use it. That's a huge problem.
Oh, and it's even more ridiculous watching Netflix. I mean, why does bringing up the Miiverse stop Netflix? It makes no sense. Like, people usually use social media while watching TV, or many people do, so why couldn't I check the Miiverse while I'm watching something?
No, you're right. I mean, Miiverse should be something that doesn't interrupt what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And, and maybe there's some interruption that you can never get around, but at least make it fast, at least make it kind of a smoother experience. And I think part of the reason that I don't use it much comes down to the Water Plaza, which I know is kind of a neat feature, and it's something that's very easy for Nintendo to kind of present and explain, and it's meant to be this kind of discovery tool, but I would much rather have my Miiverse feed, like all the announcements and my followers and the kind of all the stuff that's being fed to me from all of my friends and the people that I follow. I'd rather that be on the home screen so it's the first thing I see. And that way, while I'm figuring out which game do I want to play or what do I want to do on the system, that stuff is just right there. Because this is part of the problem. As it is, Miiverse is almost like a Twitter app that you have to go to in order to look at it, and it takes for fucking ever to load, which is a pretty good recipe for me to never use it. As part of the problem, I stopped using Swapnote. Yep. I think Swapnote is an amazing application, but because it's not built into the firmware of the system, it's an app that I have to load instead of loading a game, and it takes 5 minutes to download shit every time I turn it on, I don't use it anymore.
Well, this comes down to kind of the same reason we had some weird architectural issues, which is that Nintendo, first and foremost, is a video game company, and they are focused on making games that you load on top of your system. They aren't experts at operating systems. They aren't experts in these integrated multimedia devices where there is that focus on just upfront, how do I make this integrated as smoothly as possible?
They're getting better at it. As they get better at it, they create expectations. And as they present this stuff as being more core to why you should want to use their system, they create expectations for this stuff to actually work and to work really well. Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't quite meet that standard, it becomes very frustrating for us because we want it to be cool and we want it to be part of what we do with the system.
Yeah, I mean they have to be aware of the performance of of apps like this that are out there. You know, I mean, the fact that they can sit there and say, okay, we want to make something like, I don't know what you could compare Swapnote to really, but I mean, you have to look at what else is out there and say that we have to hit that performance benchmark or that performance benchmark. You can't just make something isolated and just, you know, have people, like you said, being driven away by the fact that something is so slow because they can go to Twitter and it loads immediately. Mm-hmm. And then they load something on their 3DS and it takes forever.
Well, the speed is partially because they rushed it out the door and they recognize that. And I think the harder things to fix are things like, how do we integrate this well? What is the best way to present this information on the system, right?
Or at least give us some options.
Right.
I want to look at the Miiverse feed instead of the Wara Wara Plaza on the home screen, mm-hmm. give me the option to turn that on. Because the Wara Wara Plaza is a bunch of people I don't know talking about games I don't own. Mm-hmm. So it's useless to me. I'm not interested in that. I have plenty of information about games I don't own. So I would rather find out what my friends are talking about and what they're playing. But it's such a hassle to go look at that stuff that I'd rather just go play the game. This is an easy thing to fix. And maybe they're already working on it. I don't know. But that would be a huge thing for me.
One last thing is that I noticed as I was playing the cave and trying to sift through to the posts with actual content in them, sometimes I would actually block some people who were a little bit too obnoxious, who were begging for yays. And blocking someone only blocks them from friending you and from, it says that it makes it less likely for them to, you know, that you will play games online with them, but it doesn't actually, you know, block their posts. You still see what they post. So it's absolutely useless. So it would be nice if
By the way, I want everybody to send Guillaume messages asking for yay.
That or
if you're a fan of the show.
Yeah, or
not just yays, but yay yays.
They should add a new level of super yays called yay yays.
Ice Cube could be, you know, their spokesperson.
Put him on your ads, you know.
Well, he's enough of a
have
sellout.
Him like kind of laying on his stomach on a white couch talking about how cool this game is. And
there you go. That would still be more manly than any movie he's done in the last.
Are we there yet?
So,
well, are we there yet to what, sellout towns? Yes, we are. So
I would say another really big thing that Nintendo can do to kind of juice Miiverse and make us more excited is, you know, I spent a fair amount of time entering friends, sending people friend requests, accepting friends requests. My list is full now, but what do I get for that? Well, it means I have a feed of posts that all my friends make that's very active, that is also very hard for me to get to, so I don't use it. But the other thing, and the main reason that I added all these people on Miiverse and spent so much time doing that, is I would like at some point to play online games with them, okay? So the problem is, as far as I could tell, Black Ops 2 does not use your integrated friend list. Maybe there's a way to do it, I'm not sure. I think Sonic and Sega All-Star Racing does, but I don't know that many people are really playing that game online. These are third-party efforts. I mean, that's the problem. There are some online games on Wii U, and from my experience, although limited, in general, they seem to work really well. But I haven't been playing a lot of custom matches with my friends in those games because I'm not sure that my friends are really playing those games, right? So what we need is a better way to see through the interface what games are your friends playing right now or what games do they want to be playing so that it's easier to set up matches. And the other thing is Nintendo has to release – now wait for it. Try not to gasp when I say this. Nintendo has to release their own first-party online games so that people are actually playing games online through the Wii U.
Madness,
so once you're actually using your Miiverse friends list to do things in games with other people in real time, then you'll feel like this is really important to the system and that it was worth doing that stuff. Right now, I don't know that they're trying to let third parties prove it out for them, which is not a good way to go. So when people talk about Miiverse integration, I'm like, well, that just kind of means there's a message board for it now. Mm-hmm. When you tell me Miiverse integration, that means I want to be able to play that game online with my friends through Miiverse. And that hasn't really happened yet. I mean, it technically has happened, but there's just no game that really pushes it to the forefront and gets people's attention. And it's going to have to be a first-party effort that does that. Once they do that, the Miiverse will take on a whole different meaning for people, and it will become much more useful. And that may encourage you to spend more time in it doing all this other stuff too. But I'm not excited about Miiverse because I want to draw things on it, because I want to draw pictures for people. I'm excited about Miiverse because it's a unified online friends list that should, in theory, let me play games online with my friends.
Should be unified, yes. I don't know. I mean, for me, the Miiverse is just it was an interesting experience for a little while, but I've pretty much, you know, I've gotten beyond it. I don't use my Wii U enough as it is. If I'm using my Wii U, it's not so I can go look at sketches of Sonic drawn by some really hardcore devoted Sega fans.
as an attraction unto itself, it is merely a sideshow.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about Miiverse is the way that it could be integrated with games. And there's several different ways that could be done. But that's the way that you'll get more people to use it.
Yeah, I mean, the Mario game is still the best way I've seen.
Yeah. And I think that's almost a very shallow way.
Yeah.
It's novel. We haven't seen it before. But I still think that's a fairly shallow way to take advantage of the Miiverse community and the friends list that you've got. And I think there is a lot more and you could go a lot deeper with that concept. So it'll be interesting to see. We'll probably have to wait till E3. But I think it'd be in Nintendo's interest to really push that and to do some really cool stuff with it. So we'll see. All right. Well, thanks, Chris, and thanks for everybody for writing in. As always, if you have a question or just an idea, a topic that you'd like us to discuss, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Also wanted to mention that we are in the process of working on a new retroactive poll. There's a good chance it will be posted to the website after this recording and before the next episode. So it might be a little while before we get to talk about it on the podcast. But if you follow us on Facebook or on Twitter, or if you just keep an eye on the website, once we put the poll up, we'll try to make it very clear. And you can go ahead and vote early and start discussing the different nominees and maybe do some research if you're not as familiar with them. But we're hoping to get that up pretty soon just because of the lead time. It takes about a month to get the poll going, get the results, go get the game, have time to play it, and then do the show on it. We want to make that happen fairly soon. So we're going to go ahead and try to move forward with the next poll. We don't know what the nominees are right now, but we're talking about them, and hopefully we'll have those set up in the next couple of days. So keep an eye out on your social media. Maybe even I'll post something on Miiverse. How about that? Maybe I'll post something on Miiverse about it and try to use the indigent platforms.
And don't forget to yay Johnny.
Yay, that's yay! Right.
Make sure you give it a yay, yay.
And never, ever, ever yay Johnny.
Well, you can right now.
And don't give Guillaume yes, just ask him to give you yes.
That's right. Please give me yes. Yeah. All
well, you can
your
give
yes.
him wee wees.
Very important.
Boo.
Wee wees. finally, I just wanted to mention, we've talked for the past couple weeks about our PAX East panel coming up and how we're so excited for it. I've got travel booked now, so it's starting to feel like a real thing that we're going to be going back to PAX East. But just this week, we confirmed actually the fifth panel member for this year's PAX East panel, and it's a guy I've been trying to get on since the first year that we did it, and he's always been too busy. He's always there, but he's too busy. He's got other things going on. And this year, it looks like the schedule is finally going to work out for our old buddy Chris Kohler, mm-hmm. Kobun Heat himself, to be on the RFN panel at PAX East. So I'm very excited about this. We've had Chris on the show throughout the history of RFN, really going back pretty far. It's always a rare and special event when he can pop up on here, and he's a good friend of ours and truly a Nintendo expert, truly. So I think he's going to be a fantastic addition to the panel. And if you're going to be in Boston at PAX East, that should be a little extra motivation for you to come. But more importantly, it's probably extra motivation for other people to come who don't already listen to the podcast.
If you're going to be in Boston at PAX East and don't come to this podcast, I hate you.
Yeah, really. You're not my friend. You're really not.
It's like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, I listen to this podcast every week, but
I promise you our panel is more interesting than the Q&A that Tycho and Gabe will forever be scheduled to do during our slot.
Did we get that again?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We always get shoved up against something ridiculous like that. But
someone talking about Dick Wolves.
Who isn't talking about Dick
Wolves?
Yeah,
you know it.
Oh, man. So anyway, that's very exciting news, and we're looking forward to doing that here in a few weeks. So with that, that's going to wrap up the show. Thank you to TYP for popping in here.
My pleasure.
Just in time, really, for new business. And thanks again to all these guys for doing the show every week. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope we'll be talking to you next week as well. Bye-bye.
Bye. Later. Bye.
I'm not going to use it. That's a huge problem.
Oh, and it's even it's more ridiculous watching Netflix. I mean, why does bringing up the Miiverse stop Netflix? It makes no sense. Like, people usually use media
apparently because of your connection.
People do, so why couldn't I check?
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Slowing down, speeding up, that's classic.
Oh, Skype never changed.
Dion, we're laughing because your Skype connection got really bad, so it was hard
to
understand.
I got that.
I okay, you sound better now, but I got the meaning.